I trust you're doing fine. Your eyes are shining clearly, and your feet are keeping time. Gliding through the lobby, he flashed a pearly smile. Watched his own reflection in the freshly polished tile. Place. Serengeti glasses enhance his chiseled face.
Like the pine trees lining the winding road, I've got a name. I've got a name. Like the singing bird and the croaking toad, I've got a name. I've got a name.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The New York City Central Labor Council's Ed Ott says the battle to save Social Security is a must-win battle of the century for labor and progressives.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years. If they do this, nothing will survive.
Ott says Social Security is not in crisis, and Republicans who have always hated it now see a political opportunity to destroy it.
They like the idea that people are out there scratching and clawing for their next meal because it lowers the wage bill for the employers. That's what it's about.
The AFL-CIO is launching a massive grassroots national campaign to stop Social Security privatization cold. Part of its mission is to give Democrats steel spine implants.
They have to get some steel in their spine on this one. We mean it. We expect them to defend the system, whatever it takes.
Younger workers, Ott says, have got to understand Social Security works and will be there. He says they should not be suckered by propaganda about a false crisis from Social Security privateers.
A new report says the Bush administration's Job and Growth Plan tax cut failed to meet its goal of 5.5 million jobs. Presented by the Economic Policy Institute, the report shows a growth of only 2.4 million.
You can see the magnitude of the deficit there. I mean, there was a shortfall of 1.7 million jobs. From the perspective of job creation, there's just simply no way you could argue that these tax cuts were successful.
Jared Bernstein is a senior economist with EPI. On the positive side, he says that because billions of dollars were pumped into the economy, it did grow faster than it would have without the tax cuts. But Bernstein says the tax cuts increase income inequality because of their slant towards the wealthy.
And that, in fact, was one of their problems as a job stimulus. They were never crafted effectively to create employment. They were crafted largely to redistribute income upward, but sold, I think, disingenuously as an employment program.
AT&T cut 1,700 jobs this week at customer call centers around the nation in Arizona, Georgia, Missouri, and New York. The Communications Workers of America represents the workers, and CWA says the cuts will hurt customer service. AT&T's consumer phone business has been shrinking, and there's talk of a merger with SBC.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The multinational Monitor released its top 10 worst corporations of 2004 last month. One of the companies on the list, Dow Chemical. According to the Monitor, in Bhopal, India, 27 tons of lethal gases leaked from a pesticides factory owned by Dow. More than 150,000 people now suffer from cancer, neurological damage, and mental illness in that region. The Monitor says Dow refuses to take responsibility for the leak.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org or call 215-563-7110.
Oh, please, please, please tell me it's true. Please tell me that Newt the Newt Gingrich really is mounting a political comeback and is planning to be the next Republican nominee for president. What a goofball. What a political extremist. What a hypocrite. What a perfect symbol of how far to the ultra-right the Republican Party has moved. Yes, give us Newt. The former Speaker of the House is renowned for having the personality of a hand grenade, with a pin already pulled. He rose to power by demonizing Democrats and all things liberal, ranting regularly about family values, integrity in government, slashing federal spending, Bill Clinton's marital infidelity, and such. Yet, this family man divorced his first wife while she was undergoing cancer treatments, running off with wife number two. But he has since dumped her as well, scampering off, this time with a former congressional staffer with whom he was having an affair. Meanwhile, Mr. Integrity in Government was a willing whore for any corporate lobbyist waving campaign checks at him, literally allowing them to write laws. Also, he was a loud proponent of fattening the military budget and rattling America's sword, even though he personally had dodged the chance to be a real soldier during the Vietnam War. After he imploded politically and his own party ousted him in 1999, the Newt did not return home to Georgia, but became a hired gun for corporate interests in Washington. Now, 10 years after his political demise, Newt says he has newly arisen. He has a new book modestly instructing us on what America should do in the 21st century, and he's using it as a pulpit to launch himself into the 08 presidential race. His platform is pure Newt. Stop driving God from public life. Fund patriotic education policies. Triple the government's spy budget and privatize Social Security. This is Jim Hightower saying, wonderful, bring him on.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library. So make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Friday, 16 below zero here in the People's Republic of Vermont. Boy, was it a cold night. It was bitter. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. It's the Tom Hartman program. It's the first hour of our Friday show, which means, of course, it's time for Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders, in 1991, was elected as the first independent congressman in more than 40 years to the House of Representatives, the United States House of Representatives. He's since been reelected 7 times, the longest serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives. His website, bernie.house.gov. Our phone number here, if you'd like to drop in or give us a call, 1-866-889-8894, the website tomhartman.com. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Oh, it's always great to have you here, Bernie. Bernie, the State of the Union address is coming up next Wednesday, and I have a feeling George W. is going to do his best to, spin things in a way that will make him look good and will kind of gloss over or totally ignore the fate of millions of Americans. What would be a progressive State of the Union? What's your take on this?
I think the first fight that we have to wage is to be honest in assessing what is the state of the union. How are ordinary people doing? And I think we can be quite sure that Mr. Bush, who is significantly controlled by the wealthy and large corporate interest, is not going to be doing that. So what our job is to assess what is really going on, than to come up with rational, progressive solutions that affect and improve the lives of ordinary people, the vast majority of the people, and then to develop a political grassroots movement that can implement those ideas. But I think when we begin and look at what's going on in America, the first question that we have to ask, if you're an average American, a regular working stiff, a senior citizen, are things better for you today than they were some years ago, or are they not? And I think all the evidence suggests that we are moving in the wrong direction. Despite the huge increase in technology and worker productivity, what's going on with the average American worker? That person is working longer hours for lower wages. Poverty is increasing, not decreasing. So what should we be doing about that? We should be honest, and we should be saying, well, our trade policy, unfettered free trade, permanent normal trade relations with China, let's be honest about it. Bush will tell us how great it is. But even for him and his apologists, you know, the corporate America and the people who want to apologize for these policies, when you have a $600 billion trade deficit, you know what, Tom? Even these guys have got to acknowledge something is wrong.
Yeah.
So I think we have to look at our trade policy. I think we've got to look at our minimum wage, in which millions of workers nationally are making $5.15 an hour. And we've got to say, let's change our trade policy so that it works for ordinary Americans, not just for corporate America. Let's raise the minimum wage to a living wage. Let us not. The president, I can assure you, in his State of the Union address, is going to be telling us that Social Security is in crisis. Social Security is going bankrupt. Do not believe it. And the good news here is that even some honest Republicans are saying, well, the president is not quite right. Depending on the study that you look at, Social Security will be able to pay out every benefit for the next 38 years or the next 48 years. Social Security is not going bankrupt. And with modest changes, Social Security will be strong for decades after the next 38 or 48 years. So the president is going to, I think, be distorting reality, telling us that maybe life is very good for the wealthy and large corporations, but ignoring the needs of ordinary Americans, senior citizens, and low-income people. What are some of the things that we should be touching on? Number one, we got to change our trade policies. We've got to raise the minimum wage. We've got to not cut back on the safety net that this president will do. He wants to cut back on Medicaid, be a disaster for millions of people. What we have got to do is fight for a national health care program that guarantees health care as a right of all Americans. We've got to join the rest of the industrialized world. You and I have talked a great deal on this program, and I know you have focused on this, Tom, about restoring faith in the electoral system.
Yeah.
And we have to make sure that in the United States we have the highest voter turnout in the industrialized world, not the lowest. And we've got to make sure that when people go to the voting booth and they use these electronic voting machines, that they know with full confidence that their votes are counted and that if there's a recount, their votes are not ending up in outer space someplace. So we've got to work on that issue. We need a new foreign policy to reverse the direction by which we got into Iraq. So there is a whole lot of stuff out there. But bottom line here is, I think that Bush's ideology really is reflective of a very small minority of the American people. And if we have ideas that make sense to ordinary people, we can rally them together politically. I think we can stop Bush's reactionary initiatives and bring about the changes that this country needs.
Yeah, you touched on a lot of territory there, Bernie. I'm wondering if you saw the piece in, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal yesterday or the day before, about, it might have been someplace else that I had it. I used it here on the air, about how China, there's this economic conference going on in Davos, Switzerland, and how the representative of the Chinese government said that the Chinese have now officially lost faith in the U.S.
Yep.
dollar.
This is huge.
I mean, the this could throw the United States into a depression that could make the Great Depression look like a picnic, couldn't it?
Here's the amazing point. Here was 20 years ago, the United States, the great economic superpower on earth. And now what's happening is not only is corporate America, and these guys are becoming bolder and bolder. We're working on a study right now, just quoting many of these CEO guys head of General Electric, many other companies, are basically saying, hey, we're not American companies anymore. Why do we want to employ American workers? We want your tax breaks. We want your subsidies, American taxpayers. Thanks for that, but we're moving to China.
Right.
But on top of that, not only is this a disaster in terms of losing jobs or lowering wages in this country, the point you're making is huge, in that with a $7 trillion national debt, you have countries like China and Japan that are buying that paper. So from a geopolitical point of view, if China owns our paper, they own our debt, you think that we're going to be standing up to them? You know, it's a funny thing. The president in his inaugural speech, oh, this guy's against tyranny. He is for freedom. Well, there was a piece in the paper the other day that in China some political dissidents were arrested, beaten up. Do you think the president of the United States is going to speak out on that?
No, not for a moment, I think so. No,
or an even
more nightmarish scenario is if China says to Condi Rice, hey, Condi, why don't you guys pull the, I think it's the 6th Fleet is in the Pacific, why don't you pull the American fleet away from Taiwan for a few days? We have a little business to do. And Condi says, well, you know, we really don't want to let you do that. And they say, well, okay, tomorrow we're going to start selling our T-bonds.
Right.
And, you know, we would be faced then with do we give up our agreements with Taiwan and perhaps ultimately Japan and the rest of Southeast Asia and the Philippines and whatnot? Or, in other words, do we defend freedom or at least democracy? Or do we give in and avoid economic suicide? I mean, and this goes right back to Ronald Reagan. This is conservative economic policies writ large here now.
The idea that the United States of America should now be fearful of taking action that might antagonize China because they own so much of our debt is beyond comprehension.
Yeah. And not only do they own our debt. Pardon my interrupting. Not only do they own our debt, they own our industries now. I mean, we can't build a missile without chips from China.
Right. And, you know, the fact that we have the Congress and this president and other presidents have sat back and allowed the CEOs of large corporations to basically slash and destroy our manufacturing sector, not only blue-collar, traditional manufacturing, but now increasingly white-collar, high-tech information technology jobs, is beyond comprehension. So my point about this whole thing is that when people listen to the president's State of the Union, listen to what he is not talking about. Listen to the reality of our own lives in context of what he is talking about.
Yeah.
I think this ideology that he is offering, this extreme right-wing ideology, is just absolutely bankrupt. I think it reflects the interest of the very wealthiest people in this country. And our job is to get out an alternative vision. Think about the things that we could do in this country with the energy that we have, with the intelligence we have. In no time at all, we could be providing good quality health care to all people.
Oh, yeah.
Every kid in America should be able to go to college regardless of his or her income. Think of how many jobs we can create by transforming the American economy from being dependent on fossil fuels to go on sustainable energy.
Yeah.
I mean, think of what a wonderful vision we could have in leading the world away from tyranny and away from poverty and all of the wonderful things that we can be doing.
Just look at what Japan has done with no natural resources other than intellect. I mean, and we're rich with natural resources. And
we are rich with intellect.
Yeah, exactly. Did you see the article in today's Wall Street Journal laying out how they're going to slash benefits for Social Security? Maybe you haven't gotten to the paper yet today.
I mean, we know that. And veterans.
This is a shocker, Bernie. They're talking about a 45% cut in benefits, and it's right in the Wall Street Journal. There's a graph of it. It's like the rich talking to the rich about how they're going to screw the poor.
Right. And a couple of days ago in the Wall Street Journal, there was another article which said, well, these veterans are just costing us a heck of a lot of money. I don't know if you saw that one.
If you're
a veteran, you should be listening carefully to what this president has to say.
Yeah.
To you. And he's not going to say anything about protecting the needs of our veterans when they come home from Iraq or the veterans who have put their lives on the line in World War II, a career of Vietnam, etc. So the point here is we have got to think outside of the box, not let President Bush and his right-wing colleagues define reality for us. Got to go into our own hearts and look at really what's happening and go into our own minds and look at a vision which is very, very different than Bush's oligarchic vision of a nation run by a small number of very wealthy people and large corporations at the expense of the middle class and working people.
And we need to get the message out. I was pleased to see, I have two articles here in my stack that you wrote that we've clipped out of the newspaper for the last couple of days. But, it, you know, in this Wall Street Journal article, publicly, the chairman of Mr. Bush's Council of Economic Affairs, Gregory Mankiw, has been giving speeches touching on the merits of such a shift. The shift that they're talking about is this 45.9% cut in benefits to Social Security recipients over a period of some years. And, you know, by changing the way that they index the increases over time from wages to prices.
Right.
And so they're getting their word out. What more can we do to get our word out?
On that note, there is some good news, as I'm sure you and listeners have noticed in the papers today, is that the Bush administration, for a variety of reasons, has decided not to go to the Supreme Court to appeal a lower court decision which overthrew the FCC's decision, which would have allowed for more media consolidation.
Yeah.
So the whole issue of how we get the word out touches on corporate control over the media, touches on the fact that we have fewer and fewer large conglomerates determining what the American people see, hear, and read, and that whole issue, the fight for alternative points of view on radio, on television, in the newspapers, is a whole other issue. But the good news is, we just won a major victory yesterday in trying to at least maintain some different points of view in the media.
At least maintain the status quo or something.
Yes, right.
It's a start. It's a start. It's Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie, our phones are lit up. We'll go to them right after this break. It's 1-866-889-8894, the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be right back.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, "Dear Mr. Oreck, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oreck XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oreck XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Increasingly, under the Bush administration, with these right-wing policies, it's a hard knock life. Welcome back. It's Tom Hartman here with you. It's Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us for this hour. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Bernie, before we go to the phones, we have a message board at TomHartman.com, and there's about, I don't know, 50, 55,000 messages on there now. Folks come in and they post messages. And we've got one section that's questions to ask me when I'm on the air. And one of our members has asked a question for you. So I guess they consider you part of our radio family, as I do. This is from Diesel Creek, one of our members. He says, could Tom ask Bernie if he plans to run for Jim Jeffords' seat in the Senate? So
what I have said is that if Senator Jeffords chooses not to run, I certainly will be running for the United States Senate, yes.
Wow. That's great.
It's no great secret in Vermont. If Jeffords does not run, I will.
You'd make a great senator. Absolutely great senator. Okay, let's go to the phones here. Joyce in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Joyce, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak to you, Congressman Sanders. And I have two issues to discuss. One is Social Security, and it never seems to be mentioned that the fact that jobs are being outsourced and that the replacement jobs pay at such a lower rate that the Social Security Trust Fund is being deprived of funds to make it secure. And the other issue has to do with Medicare. It's my understanding that the Medicare Part B premium is based upon the cost of Medicare. And if as it increases, which it will due to this phony prescription benefit, then the cost of Medicare Part B will be increased. The premium will then reduce the Social Security benefit of those who are retired. Can you address those issues, please?
Okay. The second part of your question is that what many seniors tell me, and I'm sure every other member of Congress, is they get this minimal increase in the cost of living allowance and Social Security. It's eaten up by increases in Medicare. What Joyce is saying is if Medicare continues to go up, is that going to eat up all of the COLAs in Social Security? And the answer is yes, it certainly will. In terms of socials, and by the way, Joyce, one of the things that we are trying to do is to establish a segregated index, cost of living index for seniors, as opposed to the overall analysis, because seniors' costs are going up faster than the general population, primarily because of the high increases in health care needs. In terms of the second part of her question, what the evidence is pretty clear about, and again, I want to reiterate this point because Bush will be saying something very different. Social Security is not going bankrupt. All kinds of nonpartisan studies have been done to suggest that it will pay off every benefit for either the next 38 or 48 years, and with modest modifications such as doing away with the ceiling in terms of contributions to the Social Security Trust Fund, it will be strong for decades after that.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for the call, Joyce. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Raymond in Cement City, Michigan on the line. Hey, Raymond.
Well, good morning. I just wanted to help the reframing issue. I think when Bush talks about freedom, he's talking about freedom for the predators to plunder the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you know, we just got to keep beating that message, is that that's what they've been doing, is lying ever since he started running for office, when he ran against Ann Richards. And it's an ongoing thing. And right now on C-SPAN, the Democratic Congressional Caucus Committee is listening to testimony on how the Social Security employees have been used to spread propaganda about the demise of the Social Security system, and privatization is the only way around.
Yeah.
So to make it a question is just how can we get our own Social Security system to get the right word out?
We'll have to get to that after this.
Okay.
We'll have to get to that after this break. I'm sorry, we're out of time here on that one, but we will get back to it. Raymond, thanks for the call. I do appreciate it. We shall return. 29 minutes past the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Love rules.
Our son gets mad. He tries to shout.
We'll take away his cell phone, his video game.
And if we have to, we'll take away his freedom.
He's got to understand that there will be consequences for breaking our rules.
It doesn't matter that he's not smoking. When we say not to hang out with the weed crowd,
we mean it.
That's what it takes to keep him away from marijuana.
And we love him enough to live with that.
Love, the anti-drug. Call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com for information on how to prevent your child from using marijuana.
Paid for by ONDCP.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The New York City Central Labor Council's Ed Ott says the battle to save Social Security is a must-win battle of the century for labor and progressives.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years. If they do this, nothing will survive.
Ott says Social Security is not in crisis, and Republicans who have always hated it now see a political opportunity to destroy it.
They like the idea that people are out there scratching and clawing for their next meal because it lowers the wage bill for the employers. That's what it's about.
The AFL-CIO is launching a massive grassroots national campaign to stop Social Security privatization cold. Part of its mission is to give Democrats steel spine implants.
They have to get some steel in their spine on this one. We mean it. We expect them to defend the system, whatever it takes.
Younger workers, Ott says, have got to understand Social Security works and will be there. He says they should not be suckered by propaganda about a false crisis from Social Security privateers.
A new report says the Bush administration's job and growth plan tax cut failed to meet its goal of 5.5 million jobs. Presented by the Economic Policy Institute, the report shows a growth of only 2.4 million.
You can see the magnitude of the deficit there. I mean, there was a shortfall of 1.7 million jobs. From the perspective of job creation, there's just simply no way you could argue that these tax cuts were successful.
Jared Bernstein is a senior economist with EPI. On the positive side, he says that because billions of dollars were pumped into the economy, it did grow faster than it would have without the tax cuts. But Bernstein says the tax cuts increase income inequality because of their slant towards the wealthy.
And that, in fact, was one of their problems as a job stimulus. They were never crafted effectively to create employment. They were crafted largely to redistribute income upward, but sold, I think, disingenuously as an employment program.
AT&T cut 1,700 jobs this week at customer call centers around the nation in Arizona, Georgia, Missouri, and New York. The Communications Workers of America represents the workers, and CWA says the cuts will hurt customer service. AT&T's consumer phone business has been shrinking, and there's talk of a merger with SBC.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The multinational Monitor released its top 10 worst corporations of 2004 last month. One of the companies on the list, Dow Chemical. According to the Monitor, in Bhopal, India, 27 tons of lethal gases leaked from a pesticides factory owned by Dow. More than 150,000 people now suffer from cancer, neurological damage, and mental illness in that region. The Monitor says Dow refuses to take responsibility for the leak.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman program, Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, America's independent congressman. You are still the only independent member of the House, right, Bernie?
Yep.
Yep, but there you go. And you want to take a shot at Raymond's comments?
So Raymond raises an interesting point. We're seeing in a number of ways the Bush administration use government funds to peddle their propaganda. I mean, recently there was this a lot of attention paid to this guy Armstrong. What's his name? Armstrong Williams?
Armstrong Williams, yeah. Now there's a right. third one. And we find out that the guy in the government who cut the check for this third guy used to work for him. This third guy is Gallagher. And Wade F. Horn in the Department of the Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services, he helped him found a group called Marriage Savers back in 1996. It's like a little club. They're all giving each other government money.
But the danger is that means that when you turn on the TV or you're listening to the radio, you don't know whether the guy who's spouting the Bush line actually is on their payroll. And
yep.
that is obviously outrageous. And what Raymond was pointing out is that what they're trying to do now is make Social Security employees, when people call up Social Security, that they want the employees to give a message that the system is in crisis and going bankrupt, which is clearly a lie.
Right. Not to mention that it's on their on hold message. And
right.
and did you see where in the papers where back in 1978, when George W. Bush was running for Congress unsuccessfully, he was part of his platform that he was running on was that Social Security would be bankrupt by 1988 if it wasn't immediately privatized. I'm serious. He was in 1978. He said if Social Security is not immediately privatized, the system will be bankrupt by 1988. That's what he ran on as a congressman from Texas. He lost, by the way. So it's, you know, what comes around goes around. Anyhow, let's move along to the phones here. Dave in Northern California on the line. Hey, Dave, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hey, gentlemen, thank you both for dealing with realities we don't otherwise get to hear much of in our media. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
As I view this, what you're talking about is all part of a very willful plan, that is to shift as much money as possible upward from the poor to the very rich. And as I read between the lines, there's almost a tone of arrogance now that says, that's right, but what are you guys going to do about it? We've got you outnumbered. We hold our people in line. We got these trick voting machines. The voters, the people no longer count. We've got it. What can we do at this point? I think democracy is a part of history unless we can come up with some pretty radical, drastic steps. That's my thought.
Well, Dave, your point about the arrogance is I think, very true. I mean, I think if you read some of the, you know, specialized media, if you like, that's what they are saying. They're saying, hey, we got it all. Look, we own the media. We own the House. We own the Senate. We own the White House. We own the Supreme Court. And we will do any damn thing we want. And that's right. Our goal is, despite the fact that the United States today has the most unequal, unfair distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, you got the richest 1% owning more wealth than the bottom 90%. That's not good enough. We need to shift more and more from the middle class up to the rich. And I think David is absolutely right. There is an incredible arrogance. What do we do about it? I think we have to – there's no magical answer to that, David. I think what politics is about – and I don't want to be too cliche-ish here, but it's not a spectator sport. In other words, we – all of us have the opportunity to get involved, and we got to redefine how we get involved. We have a workplace. We have our communities. We have local media. We have got to be involved 24 hours a day as the Republicans are. In a dozen different ways, in educating and organizing our friends, family, and neighbors to stand up and fight for democracy. Because you're quite right, democracy itself is endangered unless we organize and educate.
Yeah, well said, Bernie. Before we go to the next call, just I've gotten 9 copies of this thing in email. Apparently, the conservatives are cranking them out again. This email, in fact, now they're saying for at the very end, it says how many people can you send this to? I know you've debunked this before, but so many people are getting these things now, and they're forwarding them to me and others that I wanted to give you an opportunity to debunk this one more time. This email about, for example, former Senator Byrd and Congressman White and their wives may expect to draw $7.6 million, and their wives draw $275,000 during the last years of their life, blah, 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 blah. saying that our senators and members of Congress don't pay into Social Security, don't collect from it, and they got this incredibly cushy program where they're making millions and millions of dollars, and the average guy.
No, that's just it's a lie. I mean, what you had is, I can't remember what the year was before that I became in Congress. I think it was in the 80s. The truth was that Congress did have a very generous, too generous, pension program for members, and the older guys who've been there a long time will, in fact, get generous pensions, but nothing like what these people are talking about. Wives don't get pensions. Members of Congress do pay into Social Security and do receive Social Security. So all the reality is the pensions that members of Congress get today is generous, but it's not way out of line with what the private sector gets. Before the mid-80s, I think it was, it's a pretty generous pension thing. But with this email is talking about is a lie.
Yeah, I know that. And I just wanted to get that on the record one more time, because there are so many people now spreading this.
I've seen that. Yes, somebody out there.
I'm sure you're getting them too, and it makes me crazy. 1-866, and I sometimes I even reply to them and I say, no, members of Congress do pay.
The answer, I think, Tom, to say if all of this were true, given the fact that the Republicans control the House and the Senate and the White House, wouldn't they do something about that?
Yeah, well, in these emails, they always mention Democratic members as if it's some sort of Democratic conspiracy.
Right.
Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. Florian in Arlington Heights, Illinois, on the line. Hey, Florian.
Hello. Yes, question for Congressman. Our Republican congressman has vowed to help President Bush firm out the Social Security program. From a standpoint of email, he has a website. If we could put together a specific number of people opposing his position on Social Security, what number would have an effect? Would it be 100? Would it be 1,000?
This is what I think kind of – oh, sure. I mean, what I would do is say to your member of Congress, look, we would like to talk to you. And we have 50 people or 100 people who can be assembled at a mutually convenient time to talk about Social Security, and we want you to come and talk to us. If not, we would like to come into your office and meet with you and your staff, and we hope you'll give us that consideration. But the first thing that you should do is get a number of people and say, look, let's sit down and talk about this issue.
And how do you get those people? How historically have you seen it work that people get folks together, Bernie, to lobby you, for example? I mean, how does that happen?
Well, you have organizations that, you know, in your community. On this issue, by the way, AARP has been very, very strong. You'll have other senior groups. You'll have organized labor. You'll have different groups. Contact them and say, look, in my state of Vermont, as a matter of fact, we are going to be doing at least 4 town meetings on this issue.
Yeah.
We are going to be initiating.
But you're proactive.
You can demand that your member of Congress meet with you, and the job, your job, is to bring people together to come to that meeting.
Okay. Understand.
Got it.
Can you do that?
Yes. Thank you very much.
All right, let's do it. Let's take the ball to them.
Good on you, Florian. I'd love to see that happen. Our lines are open if you'd like to call in, 1-866-889-8894. Bernie, Mr. Leavitt is the new Secretary of Health and Human Services. As his first event, the New York Times reported yesterday, he introduced George W. Bush as someone, quote, who has improved quality health care for millions, end quote. And the New York Times goes on to note, the number of Americans living in poverty rose by 1.3 million last year to 35.9 million, while those without health insurance climbed by 1.4 million to 45 million, according to the Census Bureau. Third straight annual increase every year since George Bush has been president. What?
This is, you know, this is Orwellian, you know, newspeak to say that when our healthcare system is disintegrating under this president, that he is improving healthcare for the American people is totally insane. As I think every listener knows, this is not debatable. The cost of health insurance is soaring. More and more people are without any health insurance. Deductibles are going up. Copayments are going up. Small business people can't afford to have health insurance. We pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, and that situation is getting worse. Maybe I'm missing something, but I don't quite know how this president has improved the condition of health care in this country.
Yeah. I see that you've introduced legislation to set aside $140 million to establish community and school-based dental clinics across the country. Now, we have some experience with that here in Vermont, but I suspect the average person, most folks out here outside of Vermont, are not familiar with this. Can you tell us about what it is you're proposing in Congress?
Sure. This is an issue that doesn't get anywhere near the attention that it deserves. But when you talk about the health care crisis in this country, we should also be talking about the crisis in access to dental care. Huge numbers of people have no dental insurance, and the reality is that a lot of lower-income people cannot find a dentist who will treat them. In Vermont, what we have begun to do, and my office has played a role in this, is we've been able to establish dental clinics right in schools. And in a little while, we'll have four school-based dental clinics that will be treating all of the kids who are on Medicaid, who are, in many cases, the majority of the kids, free of charge. And in Bennington County, this has gone a very long way to address the crisis in pediatric dental care. And we also have community-based dental clinics as well that are treating large numbers of lower-income people. So this is an issue I want to take nationally because I think this is a serious national problem.
That's marvelous. And you're only suggesting $140 million. That's about, what, 8 hours of spending in Iraq right now?
Probably less than that.
but I'm guessing the Republicans are not going to be happy with your proposing this.
Well, there's some interest in it. I mean, I think many members of Congress understand that many people in their own districts can't find a dentist. The kids are missing school because of preventable dental problems, and it's an issue that should be dealt with. So I hope that we're going to have bipartisan support. But you're right. George Bush probably will not be talking about it in his State of the Union.
Yeah, I just don't think any time in his life he's ever had to worry about how to pay for the dentist. Let's go back to the phones. Marty in New Jersey, 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free number. Marty in New Jersey on the line. Hey, Marty, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Great.
Good.
I just wanted to say something. I work with Social Security, and what George Bush is proposing with his privatization would basically change, it wouldn't save Social Security, it would just change it into a 401k, completely changing the character of the program.
Marty, how do your coworkers feel about what's going on?
I think we're all, I haven't spoken to a lot of the people around it. They're pretty tight-lipped, actually. You know, people, I guess, a little nervous about talking about it. But the ones that I have spoken to basically think the privatization is a bad idea. And we all pretty much agree, the ones that I've spoken to, that privatization is a bad idea. The thing is, people don't realize what it is that they're going to be giving up. You know, there hasn't been enough focus on what the Social Security program actually does, the kind of benefits that it pays. The whole focus has been on the funding, the comparative funding between a private system versus the Social Security system. But there's one thing I want to mention that hasn't been mentioned by anybody, is that you get all of your Social Security tax back that you paid into the system within the first 3 years, and the only limit on you know.
That's right. And Marty, also, what is not talked about enough is the fact that it is the millions of people who receive survivor's benefits and disability benefits.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it's not just for older people who retire.
Yeah,
you get disability benefits. Somebody who's 20 years old, they could work maybe 2 or 3 years, and if they get injured on the job, you have to have a minimum number of years, but you could be in your early 20s and be collecting disability benefits.
That's right.
And you haven't worked for that long.
Yeah, that's right.
Marty,
that's a very important aspect of the program.
You know, and what the new program, what he's proposing, just make it a 401k. And with a, you know, and there's a finite amount of money in it. And what if it runs out?
Yeah,
that's
exactly
right.
People need to, you know, we need to be focusing more on what the Social Security program currently does.
What you're saying, Marty, is that the Social Security program is an insurance program. It's
exactly
an insurance
it
program.
Right.
And as an insurance program, it has worked for the last 70 years phenomenally well, making great strides in taking older people out of poverty.
Right.
And the idea of converting that into an investment program is very, very dangerous.
Yeah. Well said, Marty. Marty, thanks for the call. We got to move along. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Yes, good afternoon, Tom and Bernie. Wanted to run this by you. I guess pretty much preaching to the choir, but I'll bring it to the table anyway. I was hearing a sound bite from Sean Hannity's program yesterday, and he was saying that, you know, even if I was homeless, completely poverty-stricken, living in the street, he says, I could take better care of my retirement program than the government could. Now, on his TV show last night, he, along with Alan Colmes, had Ann Coulter on, and she wanted to make a bet with the Democratic guest and with Alan that after the end of George Bush's term, which would be just 4 years, we would have a fully functioning democracy in Iraq. Now, I don't know what kind of a planet conservatives are living on when they think that the government is totally incapable of running a program, which they have run successfully since the 1930s, i.e. Social Security, but in 4 years, we're going to bring fully functioning democracy to a country and a part of the world where democracy has been almost non-existent for 1,000 years. I mean, just exactly how do these people think?
Yeah, good point, Rick. You want to take that, Bernie, or comment?
We'll go on to the next call. These guys, Rick raises an interesting question. And apparently, the government can perform miracles in Iraq, but the government cannot continue to run a program which has run successfully for 70 years. And that's just simply an ideological bias. When government does good things for working people and low-income people in the United States of America, that's awful, that's horrible, that's got to be privatized. But when our government is aggressive in terms of foreign policy and military policy, that's just a wonderful thing that we have to continue doing.
Yeah, yeah. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Charlie in Nebraska. Charlie, actually, I got to ask you to hold on. I thought we had about 30 seconds. The clock caught me. So, Charlie, stick around. We will pick up your question on the other side of this break. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir!
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
quest for adventure ends in disaster, but an author says the journey was worth the risk. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. It looked like the perfect job at the time, though she had to pay $2,800 to get it, but Pamela Bitterman needed to get away, so she joined the crew of the tall ship Sophia to sail around the world.
The no experience necessary part was important, because I had zero, but it was just my ticket, my way to see the world.
Bitterman boarded the Sophia in 1978. She writes about her 4 years on the 123-foot schooner in a new book called Sailing to the Far Horizon. Dozens of other crew members came and went as she steadily rose to second in command. Bitterman and the Sophia weathered hurricanes, doldrums, and a near mutiny, but it was a sudden storm off New Zealand that overwhelmed and sank the ship.
We were in sight of land. We were on a short passage. In the 15 minutes it took for her to go down, from the time I called all hands on deck to the time she was gone from the horizon and we were floating in the water, I probably knew she was going down to the last 30 seconds.
One crew member died. Bitterman and 15 others spent 5 days lost at sea in two inflatable life rafts.
Each day, our prospects got worse and worse and worse. And in the last couple of days, there were no prospects. There were literally none. We had no hope, no reason to hope. And yet, there was so little despair among the crew. It did get quiet in the last 24 hours, and I know people were coming to terms.
A Russian ship finally rescued the survivors. The event made headlines around the world in 1982, but Bitterman is the first to tell the whole story in a book. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. We only have about 3 minutes left in this segment. We've got a couple of callers here. Let's get right to it. Charlie in Nebraska is on the line. Hey, Charlie, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Yes, sir. What I'm wondering is, like, on the Social Security deal, what everybody seems to forget when that was enacted 30 years ago, you had 15 people working and maybe two people collecting Social Security. It's just totally the opposite now, and it's just it's getting to be where it's a dream, you know, and I've yet to see the government be able to spend my money better than I can spend my money.
Okay, Charlie, can you hang on for a minute?
Yep.
You there, Charlie?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Charlie, when the Social Security trustees and the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office make their projections, they keep those factors into consideration. Believe me, we know that. And the evidence is not debatable, Charlie. The evidence is that depending on the study that you look at, Social Security will be there for the next 38 to 48 years, paying out every benefit, and with modest changes, will be there for decades later than that. So that information, Charlie, has gone into the calculations and into the projections.
Yeah, let me add, Charlie's
In terms about government investing your money, Social Security is not an investment program. It's an insurance program, Charlie. And what it means is that if you live, and I hope you do, to 100 years of age, if Social Security remains strong, you'll be receiving your check every month until you die.
Even though it's more than you paid into it. And also, that Charlie's operating on a half-truth, that it is true that there is this bulge coming up of baby boomers where you're going to have fewer people. What's also true is that back during the Reagan administration, they saw this thing coming. They raised the Social Security taxes so that for the first time in the history of the program, it was actually accumulating money rather than simply bringing in money and paying it out. And we've been for 30 years now, or for 20, almost a little over 20 years now, storing up a huge surplus to pay off that.
Bush makes this point, which he makes over and over again. Yeah, we know that, and that's why the reforms took place in 1983.
Yeah, and so it's not an issue, Charlie. It's a
Charlie, did
problem
you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that. You're saying raise the taxes. That's all
everybody. Nope, didn't say that, Charlie.
Raise taxes on the working man. And how much are we supposed to keep paying until we got nothing?
No, he's...
You know, every one of these programs that you guys send down the pike is funded by the taxpayers.
Charlie's been programmed, Bernie. I'm sorry, Charlie. Bernie is not suggesting to raise taxes, are you, Bernie?
No.
That's okay. And we'll just leave. We got to leave it at that.
Okay.
But it's
okay.
Boy, the talking points.
Charlie, we'll call back in another program. We could discuss it a little bit further.
There you go. Brunch with Bernie. Thank you so much for being with us today, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the
okay.
independent
thank
from
you.
Vermont.
Yep. Bye bye.
We'll see you next week. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The New York City Central Labor Council's Ed Ott says the battle to save Social Security is a must-win battle of the century for labor and progressives.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years. If they do this, nothing will survive.
Ott says Social Security is not in crisis, and Republicans who have always hated it now see a political opportunity to destroy it.
They like the idea that people are out there scratching and clawing for their next meal because it lowers the wage bill for the employers. That's what it's about.
The AFL-CIO is launching a massive grassroots national campaign to stop Social Security privatization cold. Part of its mission is to give Democrats steel spine implants.
They have to get some steel in their spine on this one. We mean it. We expect them to defend the system, whatever it takes.
Younger workers, Ott says, have got to understand Social Security works and will be there. He says they should not be suckered by propaganda about a false crisis from Social Security privateers.
A new report says the Bush administration's Job and Growth Plan tax cut failed to meet its goal of 5.5 million jobs. Presented by the Economic Policy Institute, the report shows a growth of only 2.4 million.
You can see the magnitude of the deficit there. I mean, there was a shortfall of 1.7 million jobs. From the perspective of job creation, there's just simply no way you could argue that these tax cuts were successful.
Jared Bernstein is a senior economist with EPI. On the positive side, he says that because billions of dollars were pumped into the economy, it did grow faster than it would have without the tax cuts. But Bernstein says the tax cuts increase income inequality because of their slant towards the wealthy.
And that, in fact, was one of their problems as a job stimulus. They were never crafted effectively to create employment. They were crafted largely to redistribute income upward, but sold, I think, disingenuously as an employment program.
AT&T cut 1,700 jobs this week at customer call centers around the nation in Arizona, Georgia, Missouri, and New York. The Communications Workers of America represents the workers, and CWA says the cuts will hurt customer service. AT&T's consumer phone business has been shrinking, and there's talk of a merger with SBC.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The multinational Monitor released its top 10 worst corporations of 2004 last month. One of the companies on the list, Dow Chemical. According to the Monitor, in Bhopal, India, 27 tons of lethal gases leaked from a pesticides factory owned by Dow. More than 150,000 people now suffer from cancer, neurological damage, and mental illness in that region. The Monitor says Dow refuses to take responsibility for the leak.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org or call 215-563-7110.
Let's take another peek into the lifestyles of the rich and cranky. Poor Lloyd Blankfein. He's the chief operating officer at the Wall Street giant Goldman Sachs, but it's reported that he made, quote, only $600,000 in salary last year. That's truly sad, but before you send a check to the Blankfein Relief Fund, note that at the end of the year, Goldman Sachs put a little something extra in Lloyd's stocking, a bonus of $20 million. He's but one of the top Wall Streeters who danced into this new year with a total of $15.9 billion in executive bonuses. While wages of America's highly productive workers are being held beneath the rate of inflation by the corporate elite, these Wall Street darlings are porking up, with top investment bankers hiking their annual bonuses by some 15% over the previous year's haul. You'll be delighted to know that this showering of corporate largesse on themselves has led the fortunate bankers to, quote, rediscover conspicuous consumption, in the words of one news report. Manhattan's dealers in luxury goods are experiencing a surge of giddy impulse buyers. $6 million apartments on Manhattan's Tony Upper East Side are suddenly in demand, as are such show-off cars as the Maybach, an exclusive line of Mercedes-Benz autos with sticker prices starting at $315,000. There is a sense of entitlement among those wallowing in this windfall. After all, they say, we work hard. Of course, migrant farm workers work hard, too, but, oh well, never mind. Even the super-rich bankers who try to be what they think of as modest are lost in this culture of excess. As one said, I have a sailboat, a motorboat, an apartment, an SUV. What could I possibly need? He paused for a second, then said, maybe a little Porsche for the Hamptons house. This is Jim Hightower saying, money, it's all a matter of perspective and fat bonuses.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Next half hour, a half hour at the bottom of this hour. I say this right here. We're going to have our best of the rest of the news segment. A couple of new folks who are involved in propagating the news, reporting the news, gathering the news. Get together and we'll have a conversation about what are the big stories of the week, what and what's coming up. And in the third hour of our program, we're going to have a brief, but I think you're going to find a very interesting conversation with some folks who are doing a play in New York City about how these schools are crumbling and what can we do about education. But right now, turns out George W. Bush, according to the Ireland correspondent Angelique Christophus for The Guardian, this in a UK newspaper, The Irish correspondent, she's writing from Ireland, says that they have discovered that the Bush family is actually you know, a good chunk of it is Irish. And they wonder, why is it that during the last election, Bush never mentioned the fact that they had Irish ancestors? I mean, you know, the Irish, many Irish families, households, you find a picture of the Pope and a picture of John Kennedy next to it. I mean, why would he not say that? Why, there's a lot of Irish folks in the United States who are voters. Why would Bush not claim his Irish ancestry? Well, it turns out, here's what they say. Local historians in Wexford have discovered that George Bush is a descendant of Strongbow, the power-hungry warlord who led the Norman invasion of Ireland, thus heralding 800 years of mutual misery. With a long line of Scots-Irish presidents, including Woodrow Wilson, the Irish are normally quick to claim U.S. leaders as their own. But despite George Bush's large Ulster Scots vote in the American Bible Belt, Ireland had let his family escape the genealogical microscope. It was one of those bizarre developments, says Mrs. Griffin Bernstroff. She was she's a researcher into ancestries and genealogy is the science. And she says, we traced the Bush genealogy through a Republican source in Chicago and found it was correct. People here are absolutely shocked. She says, I'm not sure what the wider reaction will be. Bush has not been seen as a great friend of the Irish. The UK, the U.S. president's now apparent ancestor, Richard de Clare, the Earl of Pembroke, known as Strongbow for his arrow skills, is remembered as a desperate, land-grabbing warlord whose calamitous foreign adventure led to the suffering of generations. He was shunned by King Henry II and therefore offered his services as a mercenary in the 12th century invasion of Wexford in exchange for power and land. When he eventually died of a festering ulcer on his foot, his enemies said it was the revenge of the Irish saints whose shrines he had violated. But wait, there's more! The genetic line can also be traced to Dermot McDurra, the Gaelic king of Leinster, reviled in history books as the man who sold Ireland for personal gain. Now, I kid you not, I'm reading to you from The Independent, or from The Guardian. Even before McMurra earned the title of Ireland's worst traitor by inviting Strongbow's invasion to save himself from a local feud, the Irish chieftain had a reputation for gore. One English chronicler told how McMurra, recognizing the features of a personal enemy poking from a pile of severed heads after a battle, snatched up the rotting flesh and tore at it with his teeth in a hideous frenzy. But wait, there's more! Perhaps the most worrying question in New Ross, this is the part of the country where these rather strange folks in Irish history lived, is whether Mr. Bush now has a claim on Leinster, this region. Yes, of course, he probably does, Ms. Griffin Bernstorff said. But there are other families in the area who have a claim, and neighbors and friends here who would put up a pretty stiff fight. I guess they don't want the Bushies as neighbors. So that's the news from Ireland. We have started a thread on our message board, questions that you can ask that I will answer on the air. For folks who are not inclined to call into talk shows, a lot of folks, you know, just are a little bashful or whatever. I mean, maybe for whatever reason, or they prefer hanging out on the message board. And so these are for folks who listen. These are folks who listen to the show and are active on our message board, which you can get to, by the way, by going to tomhartman.com. If you click live chat, it brings you to the live chat room where there's actually people right this minute talking to each other and occasionally and during the breaks talking to me. You know, about, you know, whatever's on their mind or what's going on in the program, the news of the day, that kind of thing. If you click on message boards, it will take you to the message board where there's some, I don't know, 50,000 or so messages right now of people in lots of discussions, lots of topics and different areas that you can discuss. Anyhow, Chris posts a message. He says, given the power and influence of corporate cash funding campaigns to both the Senate and House of Representatives along with the presidency, what practical measures can be implemented to return power to the people? In other words, with all the talk about changing the Democratic Party from within, or even the Republican Party, says Chris, what is the schema to accomplish the goal? Is there anything being done at this moment to affect change? Chris, the answer is yes, there's a lot being done. There are battles going on, I mean, not literally battles as in shooting matches, but battles involving large amounts of money, strong ideas, websites, access to the media, very substantial battles going on. for the heart and soul of both the Republican and the Democratic Party. The Republican Party battle is best being played out, I think, right now by Christy Todd Whitman, the former governor of New Jersey and head of the EPA in the first term of the Bush administration, who has now written a book called It's My Party Too, in which she says that the Republican Party has been hijacked by I haven't read her book. I saw her on TV a couple times, so I'm not quoting her verbatim. But essentially, my take on what she said is that the Republican Party has been hijacked by right-wingers, crooks, cranks, and what she refers to as the social conservatives, folks who put a very small number of relatively important but not overarching important issues at the forefront, and those are the only things they vote on. Abortion, whether or not the word God is in the Pledge of Allegiance, whether or not flag burning is a First Amendment, is protected under the First Amendment. They will vote on those issues and completely ignore the fact that the folks who have taken over the Republican Party have sold it out to the multinational corporations and are completely destroying the middle class in America. And so there's that battle in the Republican Party between the moderates and the conservatives. And then in the Democratic Party, there's a similar battle going on between the so-called moderates. I call them conservatives, frankly. I think they are conservative. But in any case, between the moderates, represented by and large by the kind of the Clinton faction, as it were, the folks who are in favor of, you know, unlimited free trade. Clinton pushed through NAFTA and GATT, of course, but they have some social conscience to them. I mean, they are in favor of some sort of national health care policy, but they would like to see corporations involved with it, and, you know, that sort of thing. The DLC brand, the Democratic Leadership Council, or committee, bunch of the Democrats, who have run the Democratic Party essentially since Bill Clinton became president in 1992, and have presided over the absolute disintegration of the party ever since. And the good old-fashioned progressive wing of the Democratic Party, the folks who won the two largest electoral victories in the history of the Democratic Party, when Lyndon Johnson was reelected after proposing the Great Society programs, which cut poverty in the United States in half and desegregated the South, and when Franklin Roosevelt was reelected after he started the New Deal. And so you've got the old-fashioned progressive slash liberal Democrats who say, you know, yes, there is a place for government in American life within limits, under the control of the people, in ways that serve the middle class and working people, versus the so-called moderates or conservative wing of the Democratic Party who say, well, yeah, there's a role for government in the life of the American people, but let's get corporations in here as much as we can. And that battle is being played out right now. Howard Dean, for example, running for head of the DLC, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. This is an example of that battle. You've got the DLC folks, the Clinton faction, as shorthand I'll call them that, the so-called moderates to conservatives among the Democrats, who are trying to find common ground with the Republicans. The speech that Hillary gave the other day about, you know, with the anti-abortion folks about, you know, let's find common ground. Well, it's a fine thing. But there is a time when you have to simply stand up and say, you know, here are the principles that I believe in. These are the things that I stand for. And if you folks want to get together with us on this, that's fine. And if you don't want to, we will go to the mats. So anyhow, there is that battle. And the way to join the battle, to engage the battle, is to participate as much as you can. And there are two ways to do that. One is to actually join your local Democratic Party, join your local Green Party, join here in Vermont as the Progressive Party and maybe other parties in other states. Get involved in politics at the grassroots level. Run for, as Rama. Rama's running for school board here in Vermont. You know, run for some local political office. Run for elected office. Go door to door. Share the word. Wake people up, number one. And number two, there are national groups that are promoting these agendas, that are advocates for this. MoveOn.org, TrueMajority.org is a great one. Join one of those groups and get involved in what they're doing. And it doesn't cost you anything. And participate. and spent a lot of time on the internet with the websites of Center for American Progress, CommonDreams.org, OpEdNews.com, TakeBackTheMedia, MakeThemAccountable.com, and so on and so on. BuzzFlash.com. There's a bunch of excellent, excellent websites out there sharing the news. And as you get the information, spread it, pass it along to other people. Be the modern-day pamphleteers, like the pamphleteers who brought about the first American Revolution, and pass the word along. So, you know, forward things in email. Here's a message from Bonnie. Bonnie says, is George W. Bush really a Calvinist, number one? The Calvinists, the early Calvinists, I can't speak for the modern-day Calvinists, but the early Calvinists, one of the central tenets of their belief was that if you were rich, that was proof that God loved you. And so, therefore, the wealthy, you know, it was a religious form of neo-Darwinism. And I would say George W. Bush is actually a member of the United Methodist Church, the church that I was raised in. But he is in his social policies very much Calvinistic. And secondly, Bonnie says, does Tom see as many parallels between Woodrow Wilson and George W. Bush as I do, or am I just crazy? No, you're not crazy, and I do see those parallels. Woodrow Wilson talked us into a war. He was a Democrat, by the way. He talked us into a war that I don't think we should have gotten into, World War I, a war, you know, for no good purpose. And he was the first to use government propaganda to promote a war. In fact, the public relations industry and the advertising industry largely traced their roots back to the efforts of Woodrow Wilson, number one. Number two, he told some stories to get us into that war. And number two, he passed the 20th century equivalent, the Alien Sedition Acts, the Sedition Acts, that threw into jail people who spoke out against the war. This is real problematic. So, yeah, I see a lot of parallels between Wilson and Bush. I don't like it. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
This is Vivilnik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartmann Show absolutely without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
Love guides.
My daughter has a million things going on in her daily life, from softball to band to voice lessons. My husband and I like to make sure she doesn't spend her idle time idle, because an idle mind is a playground for trouble. You see, occupying our daughter's free time and keeping her active makes us feel confident that she won't be hanging out with the wrong crowds.
Love, the anti-drug. Call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com for information on how to prevent your child from using marijuana.
Paid for by ONDCP.
Hi, this is Tom Hartmann. If you'd like to help bring the Tom Hartmann program to a radio station in your area, please let us know. We have tools to help you make that happen. For more information, go to www.tomhartmann.com and click on the Bring Tom Show to Your Town link on the left side of the page. Thanks for your help in bringing uncommon sense from the radical middle to your community.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Lie down, people. Lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. As was said back in 1776 by Thomas, or 1773 by Thomas Paine, these are the days that try men's souls. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will now, no doubt, shrink from the service of his country. But tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. And this, the response to Bonnie's question, to Chris's question, we have to get active to do this. Daniel in Oregon posted a message to our message board. He says, would you please talk about the link between buying local goods and services and saving energy? How much energy really goes into a basket of berries in January that comes from Chile? It's a rhetorical question, he says. In the area of peak oil, this seems very relevant. It's incredibly relevant, and there are a lot of good reasons to be buying locally, to be buying exclusively locally, or to the extent that you can. We're here in Vermont. We're members of a local co-op, a food co-op, the Hunger Mountain Co-op. In fact, it's called, there's a mountain around here called Hunger Mountain. And they go out of their way to buy from local farmers, local vendors. There's a bunch of folks here in Vermont. There's who are organic farming, the Vermont Organic Farming Association, whatever. It's getting huge. And there's a lot of farming with greenhouses, so there's food all year round. In fact, there's a restaurant in town that serves, actually it's in the next town over in Barrie, where they make the claim. This is a full-blown restaurant. It's kind of a diner, you know. They've got a pretty comprehensive menu. They make the claim that all of the food that they serve is locally produced. And so, you know, in the context of energy, yes, it's not only are you supporting your local economy, not only are you building up, particularly when you're buying foods, building up the infrastructure, the local infrastructure that will be necessary if there is an oil crisis. And that's an if that is almost certainly going to be a when. Not almost certainly, is going to be a when. Given the way that this administration's going, I mean, they're doing nothing about it. Ever since Jimmy Carter, Jimmy Carter was the last president to say we need to do something about this. Ever since then, it's been abandoned. It will be useful to have local food supplies. As I've told you before, Louise and I were living in Detroit in the early 1970s when the oil crisis, the first oil crisis happened as a result of the Six-Day War. And the supermarkets were empty. I mean, in 2 days, bang, empty, stripped bare the shelves because the Teamsters had gone on strike because the fuel prices were going up and all this stuff, you know, and odd and even days for gas stations and everything else. And it was kind of scary times. People were killing each other in gas lines. So, yes, to save oil and to build local infrastructure, good thing. Kenny Mack in Scotland posts the message to our message board. He says, what with George's second term and his inaugural Freedom for Everyone speech, does Tom think that he'll have the same seemingly unconditional support from Tony Blair if he decides that Iran is next on the freedom shock and awe list? And Kenny, I don't know. I just don't know. Tony Blair never ceases to amaze me. I read the story in one of the British papers the other day about how Tony Blair has come out and said that he thinks that George's speech was just fine, thank you very much, and he applauds Bush's notion. I also applaud the notion of spreading democracy around the world. I just don't think that you can do it with the barrel of a gun. People don't like being occupied. It doesn't make them feel democratic all of a sudden. And when you have democracy growing from within, as it has in the majority of the 100-and-some-odd democracies, 140, 137 democracies in the world, all except two, for all practical purposes, democracy erupted from within, and that produces a stable democracy. And it also doesn't cost another nation hundreds of billions of dollars and thousands of lives. So, you know, I applaud his goals. I condemn his methods. 29 minutes past the hour.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, Dear Mr. Oreck, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oreck XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oreck XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The New York City Central Labor Council's Ed Ott says the battle to save Social Security is a must-win battle of the century for labor and progressives.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years. If they do this, nothing will survive.
Ott says Social Security is not in crisis, and Republicans who have always hated it now see a political opportunity to destroy it.
They like the idea that people are out there scratching and clawing for their next meal because it lowers the wage bill for the employers. That's what it's about.
The AFL-CIO is launching a massive grassroots national campaign to stop Social Security privatization cold. Part of its mission is to give Democrats steel spine implants.
They have to get some steel in their spine on this one. We mean it. We expect them to defend the system, whatever it takes.
Younger workers, Ott says, have got to understand Social Security works and will be there. He says they should not be suckered by propaganda about a false crisis from Social Security privateers.
A new report says the Bush administration's job and growth plan tax cut failed to meet its goal of 5.5 million jobs. Presented by the Economic Policy Institute, the report shows a growth of only 2.4 million.
You can see the magnitude of the deficit there. I mean, there was a shortfall of 1.7 million jobs. From the perspective of job creation, there's just simply no way you could argue that these tax cuts were successful.
Jared Bernstein is a senior economist with EPI. On the positive side, he says that because billions of dollars were pumped into the economy, it did grow faster than it would have without the tax cuts. But Bernstein says the tax cuts increase income inequality because of their slant towards the wealthy.
And that, in fact, was one of their problems as a job stimulus. They were never crafted effectively to create employment. They were crafted largely to redistribute income upward, but sold, I think, disingenuously as an employment program.
AT&T cut 1,700 jobs this week at customer call centers around the nation in Arizona, Georgia, Missouri, and New York. The Communications Workers of America represents the workers, and CWA says the cuts will hurt customer service. AT&T's consumer phone business has been shrinking, and there's talk of a merger with SBC.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The multinational Monitor released its top 10 worst corporations of 2004 last month. One of the companies on the list, Dow Chemical. According to the Monitor, in Bhopal, India, 27 tons of lethal gases leaked from a pesticides factory owned by Dow. More than 150,000 people now suffer from cancer, neurological damage, and mental illness in that region. The Monitor says Dow refuses to take responsibility for the leak.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 27 minutes before the hour. And it is time for our best of the rest of the news segment. We do every Friday afternoon here. Get some folks on who really know what's going on in the news, who are right there in the middle of it every day. Today we're going to have David Sirota from the Center for American Progress and Jeff Milchen with ReclaimDemocracy.org. In fact, we have both of them on the line. Let me push the right buttons here and get them on. Jeff and David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hey. Jeff, just to introduce you both to our listeners, Jeff directs ReclaimDemocracy.org, a national grassroots organization working to restore citizen authority over corporations and realize equal political opportunity for all citizens. Their website has a huge array of information and tools for revoking illegitimate corporate power. And David Sirota is with the Center for American Progress. He's a fellow at the Center for American Progress, successful campaigner for Governor Schweitzer in Montana. And are you still editing and putting together the progress report, David?
I am. I'm in a helping out mode. I'm not the primary editor.
Yeah, because from time to time I don't see your name on it, and we use it a lot on this program. But this is such a great resource that you guys have put together there with the Center for American Progress. So let me start with you, David. What are in your mind over this last week? What have been the top stories of this week that we're wrapping up here? What do you think are the things that they're going to be talking about on the Sunday news shows? What should Americans be taking out of this week?
Well, I think the main thing we should be taking out of this week, at least on domestic policy, is the fact that the Republican Party seems to be entirely in disarray. Bush is basically losing control of his people in Congress mainly over Social Security. It's hard to believe, but you've got Republican senators talking about, first of all, not supporting Bush's privatization program. You've got some Republican senators even talking about an alternative, which would be raising the cap on payroll taxes to make the system more progressive.
Right.
Instead of privatizing the system. I mean, this is really very different from a situation just, in the last 4 years where the Republicans in Congress just basically went along with any White House policy, no matter how extreme.
Yeah, and not only that, it for a change, it represents common sense.
That's exactly right. And that's even harder to believe when it comes from the Republican Party.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. So there's a battle going on. Christy Todd Whitman, perhaps, with her new book, represents it well. The battle going on for the heart and soul of the Republican Party?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that Bush had an emergency meeting of Republican leaders at the White House this week. He then held that bumbling press conference where he didn't really have much of a straight answer on Social Security. And let me tell you something. I think this presents a real opportunity for progressives, because you better believe that Bush is not going to back off his Social Security privatization program. And the more he digs in on this, it's my belief that the more disarray he's going to see among his own ranks, and the more opportunity he provides for progressives, mainly because it allows progressives to defend Social Security, the most popular Democratic program in American history.
Yeah, and one that has worked very well, thank you very much, for the last 70 years.
That's
well
exactly
said.
Right.
Okay, Jeff Milchen, ReclaimDemocracy.org. Jeff, what in your mind were the biggest events of the past week?
Well, certainly the ongoing battle over Social Security is one of those at the top of the agenda, and certainly agree with what David said. I think one thing that's worth considering, though, is not just playing defense, but figuring out how to seize advantage of the opportunity, the fact that this is at the top of the news, to advance some truly progressive vision, such as removing Social Security taxes from being payroll taxes, to make it part of the general operating fund. Payroll taxes are the most regressive taxes, and certainly amongst them in this country, yet we're not really taking advantage of the opportunity to push the argument in our direction by laying out a much more progressive vision.
In other words, subject dividend income, interest income
exactly.
to Social Security tax as well. talk
about the importance of reinstating estate taxes and making that part of the funding for Social Security. These are some of the ideas I think are worth putting out there to avoid the argument from continuing to be drawn to the regressive side.
Now, Jeff, we have a situation here where the Bush administration last year just dropped the income tax on folks who make their living by sitting around the pool, sitting on their butts waiting for the dividend checks to arrive in the mail. Not only do they not pay into the Social Security Trust Fund or Medicare, but they're also now only paying a maximum of 15% income tax. And there was, as far as I could tell, virtually no discussion of this in the mainstream media. I don't think the average American realizes that people who make their living, the Walton family heirs who make their living sitting around waiting for the dividend checks to arrive, are only paying a maximum of 15% income tax, whereas the guy who cleans their pool could pay as much as 35, 36% income tax. How do you expect to get change? I mean, you're a national organization. You've got a lot of members on the grassroots. I'm a big booster of your program. In fact, how do you propose to get that word out?
Well, I think it has to do with a change in mindset. And progressives, for the most part, have been locked into a couple of problematic mindsets, in my view. One of them is being overwhelmingly reactive rather than thinking proactively. And that's the whole basis of our organization, is thinking not about what's politically realistic today, next week, next year, but figuring out, okay, what is it we need to accomplish? How do we get there? What's a realistic time frame for doing that? And in our case, the changes we're looking for are radical structural changes that involve fundamentally revoking the power of corporations outside of the business realm, revoking longstanding Supreme Court precedent that equates spending money to influence elections with politically constitutionally protected free speech. And that's going to take 10, 20, maybe even 30 years to accomplish, but we need to know where we need to get in order to build the road there. Yeah. So that's one of the problems I think we're looking to overcome, is this reactivity. And that's a big focus and a big opportunity. When Social Security is dominating the public discussion, yes, of course we need to stop the privatization agenda, but to simply play defense and not figure out a way to advance our own agenda out of the debate, I think, is a tremendous failure.
Yeah, which raises an important question, I think, for you, David Sirota. We talked about the battle for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. There's an equal battle going on for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. There are the conservative.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that right now the Democrats are in the throes of trying to figure out what kind of party they're going to be. And I think there's two models. They're either going to be the Republican light model, which is, hey, we're close to winning. All we have to do is make a couple tweaks here, tweaks there, maybe move to the right here, and we can get 50% plus one vote and be a majority party again.
This is the DLC model, really.
Right. I happen to think that that's absolutely wrong. The Democrats have continued to lose under that sort of paradigm for the last, I guess, you know, as last recent history. So
yeah.
I think that
since 92.
Right now there's alternate forces that basically say the party needs to become, go back to its working class roots, start talking about issues of economic class, start not being afraid to talk about inequality, economic inequality. And I think that as you see internet fundraising and the rise of new media and the rise of more progressive radio voices like this program and others, I think the part of the party that's focusing on that is feeling emboldened, and I'm optimistic that there's going to be real change.
Yeah, I was just for example, Barbara Boxer standing up in both the Ohio vote thing and with regard to Condi Rice's confirmation, she and then others following her. This was, for me, I thought a turning point for the Democratic Party. Time will tell, but are you seeing that, David Sirota?
I think the DNC race and the Boxer stuff are all part of the same thing. I think that she is representing in her way a part of this realization that the party needs to become an insurgency an opposition party. And I think that the more that side of the debate is willing to stand up for itself, both against President Bush and against the accommodationists in the Democratic Party itself, I think the more successful the party will be. I mean, this is really about the party being proud to be the party that it was, the party that kept it a majority party for 40 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the data here. The party was in power for 40 years by being a party of the working class.
Right.
It became a minority party by abandoning that. And as soon as more and more leaders realize that, it will go back to a situation where the Republicans are perceived as representing the elite, because in fact they do, and the Democrats will be the party of the working class.
Well, and in fact, the two largest Democratic landslide victories were FDR's right after he introduced the New Deal, his reelection, and LBJ's right after he introduced the Great Society and cut poverty in the United States by half.
That's exactly right. And it was a party that was not afraid to address issues of class. It was a party that wasn't afraid when the Republicans said you're waging class warfare, because the fact is, by not talking about class in this country, by not talking about economic inequality, you avoid or pretend that the issues of class don't exist. In fact, this is right now, at this moment in our history, we are at one of the most economically stratified, economically unequal situations in our history. And not talking about those issues negates that problem and actually, for the Democratic Party, forfeits their most powerful potential issue.
Now, David, though, there is this issue of if it's not on TV, it doesn't exist for the American public. I was watching one of the network news programs after the recent vote, and they simply said, on Condi Rice's confirmation, they simply said, and 13 Democratic senators voted against her confirmation. They were all senators who had opposed the war. And that was it. I mean, they didn't even mention the fact that she had lied, and that's why they voted against her. It had nothing to do with the war or not the war. It had to do with her moral failings, shall we say. Her lies were far more egregious than Bill Clinton lying about, you know, getting it on with Monica Lewinsky. We have a media now that is so concentrated, and the stars in the media are so well paid and so tied into the power structure, and the reporters who report on the White House are so terrified of losing access, and the networks for that matter as well. I remember the AP story right after George Bush was first elected in 2000, when he finally was selected, about one of the vice presidents from CNN making a pilgrimage to Washington, D.C. to apologize to the president for the quality of their coverage and to assure him that he would get favorable coverage in the future, to make sure that they would get access. And it's like, how can we break through this?
Well, I think you saw with Barbara Boxer's example, I think you saw how we can break through.
But it wasn't covered. I mean, for example, her thing with regard to Ohio got virtually no coverage in the national media other than C-SPAN.
That's true. But her discussion or her interrogation of Condi Rice did get at least some coverage.
Yeah.
And the reason it got coverage was because she was willing to do something that doesn't usually happen, and that is she was willing to, in a high-profile way, use her platform to fundamentally challenge the administration. And that's something that Democrats haven't really been willing to do in a systematic way.
Yeah.
But I think that if they do that, I think there are some opportunities. Is it perfect? No. If they behave as if they're in an opposition party, like Boxer showed that could be done, I think there will be some opportunities, and those opportunities can grow.
Yeah, well said. And I know Jeff Milchen with ReclaimDemocracy.org, I know that you're right in the thick of this whole thing. Your organization is one of the leading organizations working to break down the kind of corporate power that leads to the concentration of the media and of corporate power. Whoa! Corporate power in the media. Something there happened. And Jeff, tell us briefly about that. What do you see as the appropriate response to all this?
Well, I think part of what we're talking about is the difference between mobilizing and movement building. And what I think we learned from the 2004 elections at the national level is that mobilizing is inadequate, that we need to pay a lot more attention to creating new alliances, dividing the opposition, and creating a proactive movement for democracy. Now, at the federal level, obviously our opportunities are somewhat limited. Certainly don't want to paint a negative picture of not being able to advance positive things at the federal level, but our focus, for the most part, is going to be seizing the opportunities that exist now to build from the grassroots up at the local and state level. Yeah. For example, in Maine, if you go to reclaimdemocracy.org/Maine, you can see a potentially groundbreaking piece of legislation that's being introduced there, one that would deny corporations constitutional rights in the state of Maine and revoke the ability of corporations to spend money to influence ballot initiatives and referendum. In Montana, there are some innovative bills being pushed forward, one of which is a progressive income tax on big box stores in the state, coupled with a living wage exemption. So it has potential to build a very interesting alliance amongst environmentalists, labor, and small business owners around the state.
Yeah.
So I think those kinds of forward-moving initiatives at the state and local level are one of our best hopes for turning the tide nationally, and that's certainly, I think, the model that conservatives followed in the past several decades.
Yeah, you're doing the stuff on the ground roots, the grassroots and on the ground, and David, you're doing excellent work out there. I just want to, for our listeners to know, David Sirota, Center for American Progress, it's americanprogress.org, and just one of the best news sources on the web. Jeff Milchen with reclaimdemocracy.org, one of the finest grassroots organizations out there. Jeff and David, thanks for being with us today on this segment.
Thank you, Tom.
Yep. And we'll talk to you again, no doubt. 10 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. You are in the real free speech zone.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
Bonjour, my name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic. Turn into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555. And mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
The state of Washington lists killer whales as endangered species. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio.
The population of killer whales in Washington's Puget Sound has been declining, and the population dropped nearly 20% in a matter of only 5 years. That dramatic fall prompted the state of Washington to list these killer whales as an endangered species last April. Federal officials are now proposing a similar action. Harriet Allen is the endangered species manager with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. She says it's the job of each state to monitor and protect animals that live in its borders. If a species starts to decline rapidly, the state can list the species as endangered to alert the public and the federal government that the population is in trouble.
The important thing about our lists are the raising of awareness and the prioritizing of recovery actions for those species. By putting species on our state list, it alerts all the agencies in the state and the public to the plight of those species.
State law in Washington says that once a species is listed as endangered, the state has to develop a recovery plan. That isn't easy because the problems affecting the killer whales are not clear. Allen says researchers are investigating three potential causes.
One is the historic decline in prey populations, the salmon that they feed on. Another is contaminants. They're among the most heavily contaminated marine mammals in the world. And then third is the unknown impacts and increase in whale watching and vessel traffic.
Allen says this population of killer whales in Puget Sound use marine waters in the United States and Canada. The Canadian government has listed this group of killer whales as endangered. Federal authorities in the United States proposed a similar listing in December. A final ruling might be made at the end of this year. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by.
Yeah.
I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying,
What a brilliant talent. What an absolutely brilliant talent. Welcome back. It's 5 minutes before the hour, coming up on 4 minutes before the hour. A program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com. Their website, 1-800. If you have any questions, computer-wise, Mac, PC, whatever, but products, fixes, repairs, anything, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS. Check out Small Dog Electronics. I'd like to get back to our, just to wrap up the hour here with the questions that we have from our participants in our message board. This is from Shireen, and it's funny when you go to the printer-friendly format, it drops off the city that people are writing from. We're going to have to start printing these things in the printer-unfriendly form. Anyway, Shireen writes in. She says, thank you for involving us directly in the show. I have trouble accepting an answer like greed and instant gratification as the answer to why we are burning through our energy sources, she's talking about. She says, one of the things that keeps me up at night is the lack of attention to alternative, sustainable energy sources. She says, it's hard to believe that our national political and business leaders could be so callous after all. It's their children and grandchildren who will also suffer the consequences of their bad decisions today. Let me just address that, first of all. There is a pervasive notion among the very wealthy, and there has been for the 7,000-year history of civilization, that they are immune from the problems of the rest of us. That if the country goes into a depression, no problem, they'll make it through. And the Rockefellers and the Kennedys and so on, they did. And if there are water shortages, no problem. They can pay for a little extra water. If there's fuel shortages, no problem. They can get a little extra fuel. So oddly, you say it's hard to believe that our national political and business leaders could be so callous, but these are folks who very often they're living in gated communities. They have separated themselves from the rest of us. They really very much are, many of them, that callous, particularly at the CEO levels in the very largest of our corporations. They live literally in a world separate from us. They don't travel on public transportation. They don't fly on United Airlines. They have their own private jets. They don't have to mingle with the riffraff. So they just don't consider it their problem. With regard to why it's being ignored by so many intelligent people, I don't think it is. I think people are waking up, and we are seeing change start to happen. As the price of oil goes up, it's going to start happening more rapidly.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The New York City Central Labor Council's Ed Ott says the battle to save Social Security is a must-win battle of the century for labor and progressives.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years. If they do this, nothing will survive.
Ott says Social Security is not in crisis, and Republicans who have always hated it now see a political opportunity to destroy it.
They like the idea that people are out there scratching and clawing for their next meal because it lowers the wage bill for the employers. That's what it's about.
The AFL-CIO is launching a massive grassroots national campaign to stop Social Security privatization cold. Part of its mission is to give Democrats steel spine implants.
They have to get some steel in their spine on this one. We mean it. We expect them to defend the system, whatever it takes.
Younger workers, Ott says, have got to understand Social Security works and will be there. He says they should not be suckered by propaganda about a false crisis from Social Security privateers.
A new report says the Bush administration's job and growth plan tax cut failed to meet its goal of 5.5 million jobs. Presented by the Economic Policy Institute, the report shows a growth of only 2.4 million.
You can see the magnitude of the deficit there. I mean, there was a shortfall of 1.7 million jobs. From the perspective of job creation, there's just simply no way you could argue that these tax cuts were successful.
Jared Bernstein is a senior economist with EPI. On the positive side, he says that because billions of dollars were pumped into the economy, it did grow faster than it would have without the tax cuts. But Bernstein says the tax cuts increase income inequality because of their slant towards the wealthy.
And that, in fact, was one of their problems as a job stimulus. They were never crafted effectively to create employment. They were crafted largely to redistribute income upward, but sold, I think, disingenuously as an employment program.
AT&T cut 1,700 jobs this week at customer call centers around the nation in Arizona, Georgia, Missouri, and New York. The Communications Workers of America represents the workers, and CWA says the cuts will hurt customer service. AT&T's consumer phone business has been shrinking, and there's talk of a merger with SBC.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The multinational Monitor released its top 10 worst corporations of 2004 last month. One of the companies on the list, Dow Chemical. According to the Monitor, in Bhopal, India, 27 tons of lethal gases leaked from a pesticides factory owned by Dow. More than 150,000 people now suffer from cancer, neurological damage, and mental illness in that region. The Monitor says Dow refuses to take responsibility for the leak.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org or call 215-563-7110.
At George W.'s recent National Economic Conference, an entire session was devoted to bashing trial lawyers. And what a rollicking good time it was. A panel of corporate interests wowed the hand-picked audience of Bush partisans with jabs at the lawyers who try to hold wrongdoing corporations accountable to those of us who are harmed. George himself nodded and chuckled as panelists cried about people who sue these business empires. For example, Home Depot CEO Bob Nardelli, a fat cat Bush donor, was there, wailing that his $64 billion a year retailing Goliath is a target for pesky consumers and their lawyers. You've got deep pockets colliding with shallow principles, Bob snorted, drawing guffaws from an appreciative George who is demanding that Congress limit the rights of consumers to bring lawsuits against the Home Depots. Missing from Bush's bash fest was Mary Pinturf. Even if invited, though, she wouldn't have come since, well, she's dead. Her head was crushed by a 75-pound box that fell from one of Home Depot's high-stack shelves. Nor could Janessa Horner be there to testify. This 3-year-old's body was shattered by wood fragments when more than a ton of kitchen countertops fell 10 feet from a Home Depot forklift, splitting a main blood vessel in Janessa's brain. She died 4 hours later. Nardelli tries to keep secret the number of people killed or maimed by Home Depot, which has been labeled the most dangerous store in America. But it's known that in 1 year alone, they were getting 185 injury claims per week. Why doesn't Bob do something about it? Because it's more profitable for him to settle with the families than to change the dangerous way his stores operate. This is Jim Hightower saying, and it's even more profitable for him to back his buddy Bush, who will then push a law to keep families like Mary Pinturf's and Janessa Horner's from suing Home Depot for their loss, pain, and suffering.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour. You're back listening to the True People's Radio, the No Boring Zone. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. TomHartman.com, the website. And before we get back into the news here, I want to get into a topic that is near and dear to my heart, which is the destruction, the devastation, the wasting of public education. I have on the phone Michael Goodfriend. He's an actor and writer who performed in plays in theaters in New York, Los Angeles, and across the country, as well as numerous films and television shows. His most recent work was as a producer in The Majority Report, Janine Garofalo's Daily Show on Air America Radio. And Jim Neeson, founder and artistic director of the Irondale Ensemble, one of New York City's most renowned ensemble theater companies. For the past 23 years, Irondale has sought to transform society through theater and educational outreach programs that have involved thousands of public students
throughout the United States and around the world. And you guys are working on something really cool from what I'm reading of this and what little I know of it, which is why I wanted you to come on and not only tell our listeners more about it, but tell me more about this play called Wasted.
All right.
Yeah, welcome.
Michael here.
Great. Michael, give us a snapshot of this thing.
Oh, well, this is a wild and crazy ride through the history of education, and the tour guide is Sam Slate, the film noir detective who gets roped into trying to find Johnny, who's gotten lost in a big red school on the edge of town.
Mm-hmm.
And the first person he meets is Horace Mann, who is not everybody's typical sort of view of Horace Mann. He's kind of a mothballed, professorial kind of guy who's lost all hope in public education. And he goes on from there to meet some of the great reformers, John Dewey and Ella Flagg Young, who've both been undermined by corporate interests and business interests, starting in Chicago in the early 1900s and up through the 20s when Dewey's lab school was virtually taken away from him by the University of Chicago. And
yeah.
Goes on from there to, the middle of the 20th century and all the way up to current time. Where
do you get into, Michael, the issues of, for example, the really significant, I think, reform movements in public education that aren't generally viewed as reform movements and yet have had tremendous influence on public education, like Rudolf Steiner and the Waldorf schools and Maria Montessori and the Montessori schools?
This is Jim talking now.
Hey, Jim.
One of the things that we look at is that as far as public schools and the values, I mean, we almost say it's more about schooling than education, which involves a lot of, I would say, class issues in terms of who are the kinds of people that historically we've wanted to turn out from our public schools.
Right.
And, that always, I mean, Michael was talking about Horace Mann a minute ago, and there was the way that Mann was able to sell public education to people who are going to have their property taxes go up was by persuading them that they would have better workers for their factories as the United States became a more industrialized society.
Yeah, I'm assuming I've written 7 books on public education. I'm assuming you guys are familiar with how Horace Mann first started out trying to sell his idea to corporations.
Yes.
And that didn't work. He couldn't get anybody to take it. And then Boston had the Catholic situation.
Right.
And the Order of the Star Spangled Banner had taken over the state of Massachusetts, the secret society. They had a secret handshake, and their password was "I know nothing." And so we refer to that legislature of the late 1800s in Massachusetts as the Know Nothing Legislature.
Right.
And Mann went to them, and they had this growing problem after the potato famine of 1848. There were all these Irish who had come over, and they were now becoming second-generation Irish, and they were living rather enclavishly in Boston, and they were starting to acquire political power in Boston, and they were Catholics, and the power structure of Massachusetts not only was Protestant, but was so Protestant. I mean, this is where the Pilgrims and Puritans came from England when England kicked them out after, the unsuccessful British Revolution a couple hundred years before that. Mann came along and said, I can help you solve the problem. I break the back of the Catholic insurgency by forcing, essentially enforcing public education on them. After he'd gone over to Germany and spent his $500, spent 6 months and gotten his PhD in Fichte's school. And so I'm assuming I'm ranting about stuff you guys are talking about in your play here.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, in a play that's got a finite period of time before the audience, starts to tune out, we touch on a lot of these things in very kind of emblematic form.
Yeah.
We definitely show the sort of the dissension, the controversy that all of the special interests wrought on the whole idea of public education.
Yeah. The idea of creating essentially factories for our kids
to
produce a standardized educational product.
Yeah. We spent about 2.5 years just doing the research on the piece, and the big thing that we arrived at was a lot of the didn't the schools used to be wonderful was really a mythology.
Yeah.
And the second thing was that it was such a tumbled web. How do we figure out a way to present this? I mean, that took another several months of should it be more of a documentary form or a living newspaper? And finally, with all this, I said that this kind of tangled web thing is one day we were just doing some style work and realized that everyone in the company had a familiarity with film noir.
Mm-hmm.
And right from then, Michael started writing, coming out of the improvisations that we'd done, and the company as a whole figured out a basic structure, which Michael filled out. And it was wonderful because he'd come in and we'd say, well, who did it, Michael? And he'd say, I'm not there yet. I'm almost. But
that's great.
So,
because it's a detective story. It's a film noir
and that's
type.
What it really is. I mean, I think that the story, that the Sam Slate story and the search for the metaphorical Johnny, you know, the Johnny in the 50s who couldn't read, and how he runs through history, and the school itself becomes this metaphor for American public education as a whole, and allows almost a certain amount of time traveling. So these significant figures like Horace Mann that Michael mentioned, and Elwood Cubberley, who was another major figure in putting in this time efficiency, you know, as a disciple of Taylor.
Yeah, well, and even Woodrow Wilson got into the act. I mean, of course,
yeah.
he was an educator himself. He was the president of Princeton, was it?
Princeton.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I'm paraphrasing badly. I use it as an epigraph in one of the chapters of one of my books, but I wrote the book about a decade ago. He said something to the effect of, you can either educate people for the professions, or you can educate people to work in a factory. In the time we have available, we can't do both.
Yeah.
You can basically create a working class, or you can, you know, make it possible. And essentially what he was saying was that public education was going to be a place that was going to be part of a two-tier system, very much like what Fichte created in Germany back mm-hmm. after, you know, in 1813, his address to the German people after the defeat of by Napoleon, you know, after Napoleon defeated the Kaiser. And only Fichte did it overtly. I mean, I lived in Germany for a year with our family, my wife and our three kids, and back in the 80s. And we put our three kids in the German public schools. And our middle child, who's now in his 20s, Justin, was in second grade. He was 7 years old at the time. And that's the year we had to go in and sit in with a meeting with the teachers where they would decide whether Justin would go into the Realschule or the Volkshochschule.
Right.
Which track is he going to take? Is he going to go into the Realschule, where he can then go on to gymnasium and then on to university? Or is he going to go into the Volkshochschule, where he will then go into a trade school and he'll, you know, become a, you know, a auto mechanic or a bricklayer or something like that? And that decision is made at the age of 7. But they're very overt about it. They have a two-track system, because this is, you know, Fichte's idea. They have a two-track system, and it's right there for everybody to see. Here in the United States, we have a two-track system, but it's hidden. What most people don't realize is I don't think that there's a single corporate CEO out there who went through public education. If there are,
exactly.
They're very few and far between. They're all products of private schools.
Yeah.
We really try to address that. I mean, at one point, Elwood Cubberley says to Ella Flagg Young, do you want students to be happy or employed? And then as the play progresses, you begin to see that the whodunit in this whole thing isn't necessarily the corporate interest. It's the school board that has throughout history kind of caved to those business interests. And at the very end, you know, the head of the school board is asked, how's your daughter? And he says, oh, she's fine. We just put her in school. And somebody says, which one, private or public? And he says, oh, private, Horace Mann. We put her into Horace Mann.
There you go. I mean, and that's the thing. And it goes beyond just being dancing to the corporate tune. What it really demonstrates, and I'm assuming that in your play, from what you've said, that you're doing a good job of conveying this to the viewers, who will probably, for most of them, it'll be a huge forehead slap, you know, holy cow, I never realized, is that we really do have a highly stratified society, rigidly stratified by class, that there are two, at least two, separate public education systems within that, and that they are really class-based. And business takes advantage of that. I mean, out of one educational system, the private educational system, come the senior management of our corporations, and out of the other come the worker bees. And one of the goals that Thomas Jefferson had when he created the University of Virginia as a free college was to break that down. I mean, it wasn't even as rigid back then. Every community had their own, you know, you'd hire a school marm sort of thing, or mostly it was tutoring. But the idea that we should have social mobility through education was Jefferson's absolute passion, to the point that that's really essentially all that's on his tombstone. You know, the three things that he did, none of them being president of the United States, one of them being the founder of the University of Virginia. You're conveying that, I assume.
It's interesting with Jefferson that he was in many ways was advocating a sorting system where everyone would be given 3 years of public education, and as he said, to sort out the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, well, he was interested in a meritocracy.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, another form of class system, I suppose you could say, but at least one where everybody had a shot at it.
Right. Tom, we just heard something the other day that I wonder, it sounds like from your experience you might be able to confirm for us, which we have not been able to, is that when Mann went to Germany, that the schools were actually out of session while he was there. And so when he came back to Massachusetts, he more or less invented his notion of what a German school should be like based on what he'd seen the Prussians doing outside of schools.
Yeah, I don't know. There's some excellent histories of German education, and I wrote extensively about it. The book that I wrote that has the most information about the German basis is called Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD, because I put it in the context of learning disabilities.
Right.
But anyhow, we're out of time here. I want to plug this show. How can people find out more about it? Is there a website?
Sure. Yeah, just go to irondale.org, irondale.org.
Irondale.org. And the play is...
You can also call us at 718-488-9233.
788-488-9233. Great.
Yeah, it's called Wasted.
Wasted is the play.
What
in New York City. Michael Goodfriend and Jim Neeson, thanks for being with us today. I do appreciate it.
Good talking to you again.
Yep. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir!
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, "Dear Mr. Oreck, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oreck XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oreck XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider the Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
So, how many Bush administration officials does it take to screw in a light bulb? Here's your light bulb joke for the day. How many Bush administration officials does it take to screw in a light bulb? Here's the answer. None! There's nothing wrong with that light bulb. Its conditions are improving every day. Any reports of its lack of incandescence are a delusional spin from the liberal media. That light bulb has served honorably, and anything you say undermines the lighting effect. Why do you hate freedom?
There you go. How many Bush administration officials does it take to screw in a light bulb?
None. Cheney's Energy Task Force records may be protected. Did you catch this? It's just amazing. This was a 3-inch, well, let's see, maybe it's 4 inches, 4-inch tall story buried on page, 9B or something, so the backside of the letters to the editor of my local paper here. I mean, there's only one section that actually has news in it in the local paper. There's a news section, a sports section. That's how small the paper is. But this little story, the headline, this should have been the front page. Or this should be on the front page of the New York Times. Cheney's Energy Task Force records may be protected is the headline. And here's the story. It's an AP story. Federal appeals court judges expressed skepticism Thursday over a lawsuit brought by groups seeking to learn whether the energy industry unduly influenced a panel that drafted the Bush administration's 2001 energy plan. The Sierra Club and Judicial Watch claim the public has a right to know what role energy company executives played in crafting industry-friendly recommendations. Isn't that quaint? I mean, isn't that just so quaint? This is the reason why, if you tune into right-wing talk radio, you're going to hear people ranting about Hillary Clinton's political ambitions or whether or not they should allow the under God to be in the Pledge of Allegiance, or whether or not SpongeBob SquarePants is gay, or whether, you know, this is why when you tune into right-wing talk radio, you're going to hear the kind of rants that you're hearing, because they don't want you to know about this stuff. They would rather you didn't know the real agenda of the so-called conservatives in America, both the Republicans and many of the Democrats, which is basically handing off our democracy to a small but very wealthy elite. The top 1% in America own more of this nation than the bottom 90% combined. And they'd just rather you didn't know that. And they'd just rather that there was no discussion. Thank you very much.
about whether the public has a right to know what role energy company executives play in crafting energy industry-friendly recommendations. I don't have Bill Bennett's addiction, so this is a rhetorical comment. But if I did, if I was a gambling addict, I would bet good money that you could call up 50 or 100 regular listeners to right-wing talk radio and ask them, you know, just really simple stuff like, did you know that the guy who's in charge of the new Department of Energy ran a company for years and years and years and a major stockholder, CEO of the company, that was labeled one of the five worst polluters in the nation, and that George W. Bush cut him special deals and exemptions for his pollution while he was in Texas, pollution that was killing people? I bet they're totally clueless. I just asked them that's a more recent one. Here's one that has been around for 3 years. Did you know that the energy policy of the United States was crafted behind closed doors by Ken Lay and a bunch of other folks from the oil and nuclear industry? I'll bet they don't know. Just like they don't know that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. 70% of Bush voters. Yes, there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Yes, we found them. And yes, they say the guys who flew into the towers in 9/11 did so because of Saddam Hussein, because he sent them. This is Bush voters. This is the people who watch Fox World, right? Fox News. It's a tragic state of affairs in America. We got to change it, my friends.
Love guides.
My daughter has a million things going on in her daily life, from softball to band to voice lessons. My husband and I like to make sure she doesn't spend her idle time idle, because an idle mind is a playground for trouble. You see, occupying our daughter's free time and keeping her active makes us feel confident that she won't be hanging out with the wrong crowds.
Love, the anti-drug. Call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com for information on how to prevent your child from using marijuana. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for a Drug-Free America.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. I'm Rebecca Jameson.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The New York City Central Labor Council's Ed Ott says the battle to save Social Security is a must-win battle of the century for labor and progressives.
We cannot afford to lose this fight. This is the end of everything that we built over 75 years. If they do this, nothing will survive.
Ott says Social Security is not in crisis, and Republicans who have always hated it now see a political opportunity to destroy it.
They like the idea that people are out there scratching and clawing for their next meal because it lowers the wage bill for the employers. That's what it's about.
The AFL-CIO is launching a massive grassroots national campaign to stop Social Security privatization cold. Part of its mission is to give Democrats steel spine implants.
They have to get some steel in their spine on this one. We mean it. We expect them to defend the system, whatever it takes.
Younger workers, Ott says, have got to understand Social Security works and will be there. He says they should not be suckered by propaganda about a false crisis from Social Security privateers.
A new report says the Bush administration's job and growth plan tax cut failed to meet its goal of 5.5 million jobs. Presented by the Economic Policy Institute, the report shows a growth of only 2.4 million.
You can see the magnitude of the deficit there. I mean, there was a shortfall of 1.7 million jobs. From the perspective of job creation, there's just simply no way you could argue that these tax cuts were successful.
Jared Bernstein is a senior economist with EPI. On the positive side, he says that because billions of dollars were pumped into the economy, it did grow faster than it would have without the tax cuts. But Bernstein says the tax cuts increase income inequality because of their slant towards the wealthy.
And that, in fact, was one of their problems as a job stimulus. They were never crafted effectively to create employment. They were crafted largely to redistribute income upward, but sold, I think, disingenuously as an employment program.
AT&T cut 1,700 jobs this week at customer call centers around the nation in Arizona, Georgia, Missouri, and New York. The Communications Workers of America represents the workers, and CWA says the cuts will hurt customer service. AT&T's consumer phone business has been shrinking, and there's talk of a merger with SBC.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The multinational Monitor released its top 10 worst corporations of 2004 last month. One of the companies on the list, Dow Chemical. According to the Monitor, in Bhopal, India, 27 tons of lethal gases leaked from a pesticides factory owned by Dow. More than 150,000 people now suffer from cancer, neurological damage, and mental illness in that region. The Monitor says Dow refuses to take responsibility for the leak.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So Dick Cheney dressing down here. He's showing up. This is remarkable. Showing up at the Auschwitz. This was yesterday, the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And Dick Cheney, everybody's wearing black coats and top hats and dressed formally. I mean, warm. You can wear a scarf. Dick Cheney shows up in a ski parka and a knit cap that says Staff 2001 embroidered on it. Like he's going to Aspen. What is going on? I'm wondering. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service, our daily report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Good. Great to be with you, actually.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to have you here, Greg. Any blowback on Dick Cheney's dressing down here in Washington, D.C.?
No, I actually saw that earlier. It's funny you mention that because I think what happened is I think he forgot to pack the right clothes.
You're kidding. The vice president of the United States can't call up the day before and say, hey, I thought he had a valet.
What's the dress code for this kind of event? I know, right? I mean, you think he would.
Yeah.
I mean, but my favorite part of the story is I read a story. It's being commented on by the style director of the Washington of the Washington Post.
Uh-huh. Yes. Dana,
I mean, people are really talking about this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it goes beyond style. I mean, this is a slap in the face having lived in Europe, I'll tell you, the Europeans are very sensitive to this kind of nuance.
Right.
The average American may not notice this, but
Well, it's a very somber event. It was a very somber occasion. It was a very somber place, of course. And so the fact that the story got picked up on is not a surprise to me.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Greg, what's happening in Washington, D.C.? What's the news
out of
the
city? Well, I feel like, Tom, we should talk about how much longer it's going to be before we're all using the word payroll gate or paid reporter gate or some kind of gate.
Yeah.
For all these new reporters. Now there's another one who was paid $4,000 by the same HHS. Talk about the marriage initiative.
This is the fourth one or the third one?
I think this is the third one.
Okay. This is the guy, I'm forgetting his name.
Mark McManus.
There you go. Yeah.
And, I've heard from a few people have said, look, when it was Armstrong Williams, that's a one time. It could have been a very isolated event. Now we're into two, Maggie Gallagher. Now we're into three, Mike McManus. I mean, I think people are starting to wonder, is this an ongoing policy now?
Yeah, well, my question is, how do I get part of this gravy train?
I don't know if you read Maureen Dowd.
I did. I'll say this.
The funniest article.
This space for sale.
This space for sale. Throw some money my way. I was talking to someone else the other day, and they said, look, I've been to the Talk Radio News Service, and, I don't know, for your listeners, you can tell them, we don't have, we're not CNN.
You guys are not the fanciest operation in town, yeah.
Yeah. And
you do good work, but you're
doing
it on the radio.
Work, but, we're very limited in our resources. And so they were said, are you guys on the payroll? And I said, have you been to our offices? Do you think we've been paid thousands of dollars by the government? If you had, we'd have better stuff here.
Yeah, well, but you got to be careful. You answer a question with a rhetorical question, and people will assume you're saying yes.
I'm going to say right now on the Tom Hartman Show, no, we are not on any payroll.
Okay, and I'll say that I am not either.
Okay,
doggone it.
I know. Yes. I mean, what's interesting is this new case, this, Mike McManus, he received $4,000 from Health and Human Services. And, it's being called a consulting fee, which is a little different than being paid to talk about something. But still, at the end of the day, he's paid by the government to promote an agenda item. And, I don't know. How many more people are there going to be?
Yeah, well, you know, it was World War One, and Woodrow Wilson, who was the first time that got, I mean, you know, people argue that the cons like to argue that Thomas Jefferson started it by having a friend of his who published the Aurora run a bad story about John Adams, you know, back in the 1800 election. But really, the first time that the government itself, using federal money, paid for a propaganda campaign directed toward the United States, the people, the citizens of the United States, in order to change their mind about public policy, was when Woodrow Wilson did it to get us into World War One, to cause people to overcome the traditional isolationist thinking of Americans and get us into World War One. And I think that, you know, for a long time, there was a, and this came out in the 30s. I mean, this came out during the Roosevelt administration that Wilson had done this, and it was a bit of a scandal. And you read the histories. I know about this because I used to run an ad agency. I used to teach advertising and marketing to ad agencies. And I was going to say,
love that you know that, Tom. That's a great story.
Yeah, and you read the histories of advertising and marketing, and that's really where the industry started, the PR industry anyway.
Really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that. That's
generally regarded as the beginning of the public relations industry in the United States was Wilson and World War One, and it was viewed as, and by the 30s, and as it became common knowledge, it was viewed as a bit of a scandal and something this just shouldn't happen. It just shouldn't happen. And through the Roosevelt administration, I mean, there were people who were accusing, in fact, Franklin Roosevelt of trying to influence public opinion to get us. Republicans were accusing him because they called the Democrats the War Party after World War One,
right.
Accusing Roosevelt of trying to get us into World War Two. And he wasn't. I mean, I know he saw it coming. You read the histories of the time and the notes of the people who knew him. He saw that there was no way we were going to avoid it. And yet the pressure from the Republican Party was so intense not to get involved in World War II. And you had, you know, major public figures like, you know, Charlie Lindbergh running around going, everything's fine. Hitler's a good guy. Don't worry. Be happy. And Rex Stout published this book, The Illustrious Dunderheads, which is a collection of the speeches on the floor of the House and Senate by Republicans against entering World War II, all given within a year of the time that we entered World War II. And, you know, just pointing out the insanity of these guys, essentially. But Roosevelt was accused of doing what Wilson had done, and he was very explicit that he was not doing that. He was not using government money to do public relations. Eisenhower certainly wouldn't have done it. He would have been horrified by it. Nixon probably would have if he could have gotten away with it. But I don't.
Right.
You know, there's no evidence that he ever did it. As far as I can tell, Woodrow Wilson did it, and George W. Bush did it, and now I read in one news report today that actually the Clinton administration had a PR budget that was about half of that of the Bush administration. I'm wondering when this began in modern time. Did it begin with Clinton? Did it begin with Bush? Did it begin, you know, with Bush Sr.? Did it begin with Reagan? Wouldn't surprise me if it began with Reagan, because that administration very much had the attitude that the press was, that they were running the administration like a business. But that, I'm assuming that you don't know off the top of your head, Greg.
You know, I don't, but that's a great question. It actually has me thinking, you know, you just mentioned during the Clinton administration, they had what I guess would be like a PR budget. I mean, I wonder if it was fully disclosed, because a lot of what I'm hearing these last couple of days is obviously it's wrong for the media to be paid by the government to promote an agenda.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, part of this, I think, part of this problem was that this wasn't fully disclosed.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say all of the problem. Well, no,
right.
Part of the problem. Because, see,
yeah, part.
Every year from, I forget which year it started, I think it was 1951. Every year since then, it was, I'm pretty sure it was 51. It might have been 53. But every year since then, the appropriations legislation, the big appropriations legislation, always has attached to it a paragraph that says that none of this money shall be used for propaganda purposes directed at the American people. And that's why, for example, it was illegal for the Voice of America to be heard inside the United States. Because even though it was our propaganda, you know, directed at the Soviet client states, it was still propaganda.
Still a political message.
That's right. It's why the beaming to Cuba, you know, they got these radio stations down in Florida that beam to Cuba, beam our propaganda to Cuba, and they have to have these really, really tight arrays where they have multiple antennas so that they're creating
basically a very focused radio signal going south rather than any of it coming north. Client states, it was still propaganda.
Still a political message.
That's right. It's why the beaming to Cuba, you know, they got these radio stations down in Florida, the beam to Cuba, beam our propaganda to Cuba, and they have to have these really, really tight arrays where they have multiple antennas so that they're creating basically a very focused radio signal going south rather than any of it coming north, because it would be against the law if Americans could hear that, and or if it was directed at Americans. And so this is a clear violation of the law, and this would make a great op-ed piece, and I hope some investigative journalist, maybe you can put the bug in somebody's ear about this, when did this start, and how does it tie into what Woodrow Wilson did, and to what extent was that rider in all the appropriations, you know, a result of the disgust over Wilson's activities with World War One and all that kind of stuff. So anyhow,
you have my interest peaked now.
Good. Well, do something with it.
Exactly.
Tag, you're it. Pass it along. Now, what else is happening in Washington D.C.?
Well, you know, this morning the president went to the Department of State to the swearing in of the new Secretary of State, Dr. Condoleezza Rice. So that was a big news flash.
Yes.
And all the violence, all the insurgents of the world. So it's already begun.
Yeah. Yeah. And wouldn't, I mean, I, as much as I would be the very first to say it was not, it is not worth 1400 American lives and more to come, no doubt. It is not worth, $200-300 billion of our treasure. It is not worth 10,000 people losing an arm or a leg or an eye. It's not worth hundreds of thousands of our soldiers being psychologically wounded. It's not worth 100,000 civilian deaths in Iraq. None of it is worth it. It's not worth the loss of American prestige around the world. I mean, this has been an absolute and utter disaster. All that said, if the outcome of this is what the neocons say it will be, which is that their democracy does come to Iraq, you know, that will hopefully be a good thing. And, you know, there is a point at which I think that all of us, regardless of our politics, have to step back from the partisan position and say, we want the best for our nation. We want the best for the world. We want the best for other nations. We're already there. I mean, it's a tough one.
It's a very tough one. And it's sort of like, you know, it's what you just said. It'd be great if everywhere in the world, if people were free to vote, if people had freedom and democracy everywhere around the world, we just have to stop and think about it. What cost to us, our reputation, our soldiers?
Well, and not only that, if you look at the history of democracy, I mean, there's 137 nations in the world that are considered democratic. Only two of them got that way by virtue of somebody coming in and sticking a gun in their face, and that was Japan and Germany. And those two got that way as a result of national insanity. And when countries go nationally insane, I mean, when the average person in a country gets swept up into the fervor of a cult, in the case of
pandemonium, cult behavior, exactly.
Yeah, it really is cult behavior. And my father was in the occupation in Japan. He was young enough that he joined the army just as the war was ending, and so they sent him off to Japan as part of the occupation forces. And he got there just, you know, right after the war ended and spent, I don't know, a year or so there, and he said that the Japanese people, and I'm paraphrasing terribly, but, you know, I've heard these stories throughout my life, that the Japanese people had been so indoctrinated into this idea that the emperor was the descendant of the sun god and, you know, emperor worship and all this, and he can do no wrong, and that they were willing to fly kamikaze planes onto the battleship aircraft or aircraft carrier decks. And yet at the same time, the minute the emperor said, okay, that's it, war's over, it stopped. And it was like the people suddenly shook their head and woke up and said, oh, wait a minute, we've been believing a lie. We've been members of a cult. We've been brainwashed. It's not the way we thought it was. And the same thing happened in Japan, in Germany, when I lived in Germany for a year and I talked to Germans who are elderly, and they say, you know, when they realized the extent of the horrors at the end of the war, it was like this, even the ones who kind of knew and were just hoping that they could ignore it, there was this national awakening, this national, you know, shudder of, oh my God, we did what? And then a nation will say, okay, fine, come on in, occupy us, help us out. We'll take democracy. We'll take the Marshall Plan. We'll go ahead. But that's a very different situation from going into a country like Iraq and saying, you guys have a dictator. We're going to kick him out. And by the way, we're going to occupy your country and take your oil.
It's just a whole different situation. When I hear Khan say, "Oh, we're doing what we're doing in Iraq is no different than what we did in Germany and Japan," I'm sorry, it's light years different. It is light years different. And the history of democracy shows that you cannot impose it at the barrel, at the end of a barrel of a gun, except in extremely weird circumstances like World War II. And that when you try, the results are worse than, I mean, look at, the British tried this in Iraq already in the 1920s.
You know, I was just about to say, when you do that, just like you said, when you do that, you create an almost inbred insurgency. And sure enough, that's exactly what's happened.
Yeah. And it's happened over and over and over again.
And it's happened over and over again.
Nobody
it's
likes to
now,
be occupied.
And the fact that it's happening in Iraq against us is not a shock. And that I believe that's been part of the problem, is that why did no one think of this beforehand?
Well, and it's not like it's rocket science. I mean,
exactly.
I am as horrified by George W. Bush as probably any human being on earth. I mean, because I'm in the middle of it. I mean, I'm reading the news every day and I'm talking about this stuff. And I'll tell you, Greg, if Canada tomorrow was to invade the United States, you know, say that there was sudden national insanity in Canada and Chrétien goes, we got to get those Americans. We got to stop them. They have weapons of mass destruction, after all. And they invaded the United States and they were pouring over the Canadian border, which is only an hour and a half north of me.
Right.
I don't have a gun, but if I did, I would be out in the streets. I would defend my nation. I would defend George W. Bush. He's my president. I would defend him, and if our country was under attack. So I don't think that we should consider, and I think that that's the instinct of every American. And so I just don't get it, how people think it was odd, or, you know, that we failed in our planning, to fail to think that people in another country might think the same way, you know, that they might put their country ahead of. I'm ranting here, but Greg, thanks a lot for. We got to wrap up this segment. Greg Gorman. With the Talk Radio News Service. Great talking to you. Great talking to you again. It's been a while. I appreciate you coming on the show. Greg Gorman of the Talk Radio News Service. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 10 minutes before the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. Yeah, you'll hear it here. Hear it here? Hear here. Yes.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What to tell you about DemocraticMatch.com? You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper.
Fungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozark. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.hollers.com. That's www.healing-holler.com.
People tend to adopt symbols of the places where they live. But what happens when those symbols disappear? I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio.
Most people remember favorite landmarks from early in their lives. They range from prominent features to small patches where they played as children. Howard Mansfield says these places represent what he calls our Axis Mundi, or center of the world.
Throughout our landscapes, there are magnificent trees, there are churches, there are rock things that we name that become landmarks to us. And that's our connection to place. And as we pave the world over, we overturn this Axis Mundi, we overturn these central places, and that's part of the disquiet people feel.
Mansfield is the author of a new book, The Bones of the Earth. He says our landmarks can be small and personal or large and public, like New Hampshire's Old Man of the Mountain. This rock feature, which resembled a human profile, crumbled away in 2003.
People were so upset. They said, that's my life that fell down. I saw the old man first thing in the summer. I saw him last thing going home. I said hello to him all the time. And the other thing that upset people was, wait a minute, stone is supposed to be eternal. But stone, too, is a ticking clock. Again, you get that idea of change. Everything is changing.
Mansfield says our connection to landmarks makes them worth fighting for.
Just because it's an emotional or an intuitive sense of place doesn't mean that it has no value and that it has to immediately fall to somebody's plan to bulldoze a pasture or widen a road, because that does not necessarily have the right of way. It's the other thing. It's the sense of place that is more important that should win the day.
That's Howard Mansfield, author of The Bones of the Earth. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air.
And welcome back. Yes, democracy is coming. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, the phone line's all lit up. What did I say? That I defend George W. Bush? That must be it. I don't know. We'll find out. Martha in Massachusetts. Hey, Martha.
Hi, Tom. Don't take this the wrong way, but at this point, I think I'd welcome the Canadians to invade the United States.
Well,
there was
a caveat in there, Martha. I had said if they went nationally insane and decided to come and get us, I really think that the reality is that in every nation, people would rather have, I don't want to say they'd rather have the devil they know than the devil that they don't, but they'd rather have their own, countries need to work out their own stuff.
I know.
You know, I mean, that's the bottom line.
But don't you think we have gone nationally insane?
I do.
Half of us, anyway.
I do. George W. Bush has created a cult around him. There is a cult of personality. There are scary parallels between what we're doing here and what Germany did.
Well, you know, the worst of it is he's in control of the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world.
Yeah.
Now, doesn't that scare you?
Well, yes and no. I'm frankly more concerned about what he's doing economically. I don't think he's going to use the nuclear arsenal. But yeah, okay.
Just that fact.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
You know, maybe I have to reconsider whether I would be upset if Canada invaded or not. Martha, thanks for keeping me honest. I appreciate it. Let's go to Ed in California. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Two things. I was envious of you having a dental program.
Yeah.
But then Bernie announced this morning that you have it for free in Vermont for a clinic.
That's only if you're a kid and if you live at 150% of the poverty level or below.
You don't qualify?
No, I pay for my dental stuff out of my own pocket.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Well, the second thing is that I think up until now that they definitely proved that women make less than men.
Yes.
Because look at the difference in the price that Mr. Armstrong got and the other female reporter.
There you go. Okay. Good
Have
point.
A good, day.
Good point, Ed. Thanks a lot. Tim in Illinois on the line. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Here's a compassionate conservative hypocrisy alert. A couple of weeks ago, I phoned about this maniac con, Matt Blunt, who just was elected governor in Missouri and busted all the state employee unions. But anyway, Now he's proposing to balance the budget there by throwing thousands of people off Medicaid.
Yeah.
By lowering the qualification threshold to 30% of federal poverty level.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, and there's more to come, Tim. I guarantee you, there is more to come. This is the whole conservative agenda is to roll back
the New Deal, to undo what Franklin Roosevelt did, to roll it back. Thanks so much for being with us today. Thanks to Louise for producing our show, to Ira for engineering it, to Shelby for streaming us around the world, for Ben Birch for his archives at WhiteRoseSociety.org, Shelby at RadioPower.org, to Jay for our music, to our sponsors, to Brad New York, to the folks in our chat room, which just crashed. Thanks to you all. We'll see you. Mike Toth for our archives. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vivionik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show absolutely without